You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week, Colin Bevan. Colin attracted international attention for his year-long lifestyle redesign project and popular book and documentary film, No Impact Man. He's appeared on Nightline, Good Morning America, The Colbert Report, The Montel Williams Show, and NPR. His story has been featured in news outlets from Time Magazine to The New York Times. He is a sought-after speaker by wide-ranging audiences. He consults with businesses on improving eco-friendly and human-centered practices and lives in Brooklyn, New York. And Colin Bevan's new book is called How to Be Alive, A Guide to the Kind of Happiness That Helps the World. Sounds like the kind we need. Colin, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
It's great to have you here. I've appreciated the two books of yours that I know about and the movie. And I suspect a lot of people are familiar with the book and the movie No Impact Man. Bring us up to speed. To what extent are you still living that way?
I guess first of all, I should say that the No Impact Man project was a project that I launched back in 2007, where I lived with my family as environmentally as possible in New York City, and it was a response both to what we were doing to get our oil, namely the Iraq and the Afghanistan wars, and what was happening when we burned our oil, which was climate change, and then the fact that the way of life that all of that energy was supposed to power didn't seem as happy as I thought it should be. I saw people working 10, 12, 14 hour days, not using the talents or the passions that they cared about, not spending enough time with their loved ones. And those were the lucky ones, sometimes people not being able to make ends meet at all. And so it seemed to me that there was something wrong with the way we were running things. And so I launched this year of living environmentally. And it was extreme in a certain sense. Like I really went the whole hog. And what I discovered out of it was that some of the practices that I thought I was doing for the sake of the environment actually made me happier. And so I've kept a lot of practices. So, for example, vegetarianism turns out to be better for my heart and better for the world and better for my heart. So it's healthy for me to stay that way. Or in the city, I'm able to get around by walking and biking, which means I get exercise as part of my daily routine, as opposed to taking a taxi to the gym to get on a treadmill and then run in place.
Makes a lot of sense.
Pardon me?
It makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And most importantly, I think, is that No Impact Man year taught me that I have a voice and that each of us has power to change their own lives and the lives of those around them. And that's what I continue to do. And How to Be Alive is just about that. Like, how can we wake up to the fact that we have the power to change our own lives and the lives of those around us.
Obviously, just one person doing what you did is admirable but doesn't save the world. But if you make a book and a movie about it and people start following your example, that could have a significant impact. To what extent do you know that anyone is following even partially the example that you set?
Well, I started a nonprofit called the No Impact Project, where we run this program called No Impact Week, and people live as environmentally as possible over the course of a week, and it runs in businesses and different kinds of institutions. And over 70,000 people have done that. So, but also in terms of this question of whether one person can make a difference, a couple of things. I mean, this is how cultures change. We tend to think, how could I change anything? I'm just a cog in the machine. Except the machine is only made up of cogs. So if enough of the cogs change, then the machine changes. And of course, if enough of the cogs gather together in collective action and let their political representatives know that they expect change, they can change. They can make things happen too. So we have to be careful of this meme that one person can't make a difference, because actually, if all of us say that, then definitely we won't make a difference. But if all of us say we can make a difference, then we in fact will.
Well, I agree, needless to say, but one person makes a difference by influencing more than him or herself. And I think, you went very, I don't know if you went no impact, but you went very low impact, right? You went from the American average of 16,000 pounds of trash a year, I think you documented at one point, to very few, if a pound of trash, I imagine. And yet, if you live in a city or a town, you engage with the consumption that happens there. If you pay taxes, you are funding wars and subsidies for fossil fuels and so on. So at some point, we need a general solution. And I take that to be in part the message of the new book, that we have to accomplish something collectively.
Well, things change. I think of change happening in society as kind of like a cultural two-step. So if you think of, let's take marriage equality, thinking back when civic unions between same-sex couples were first allowed in California. So if you think about that, first the culture changed. So it became more okay socially, as far as people were concerned, for same-sex couples to live together. And then the legislators followed that change in culture by legislating that it was okay for there to be civic partnerships. And then they moved on to – then the culture changed some more. And then the legislators moved on from there and said it was okay to have same-sex marriages. So in other words, what happens is it's this cultural two-step of regulatory and, institutional change followed by cultural change followed by institutional change. So changing the way we live as a culture and our individual lives is important, but also getting involved in our civic structures, our businesses, our governments, our religions, all of those things, and causing those systems to change is also important. And so how to be alive is partly about that. It's partly about the fact that there's a disease in the culture, this kind of feeling that things are going wrong, and none of us know how to solve it. So how do we find ways in our own lives to actually change and act differently, live according to our values, and be involved in the bigger systems too?
Yeah, and that's what's interesting about the book, is it really is a guide to how to live in a way that will benefit both you and the rest of the world. And you cite a poll that only 30% of people in the United States that have jobs feel engaged by those jobs, which is incredibly sad. And a big part of the message regarding how to live seems to be that you should figure out a way where your job can be working to make the world a better place and find satisfaction in that. Is that right?
Sure. I mean, so basically, there was this idea in our culture that, you go to college, no matter how much in debt you have to go to get that, because that will get you a great corporate job, which may not be exactly what you want to do, but at least you'll get health care and retirement benefits. And not only that, you'll be able to afford a big mortgage so you can have a big house, and eventually you'll retire and go on lots of cruises. And the idea was that you would have a safe and somewhat happy life, and that somehow you were actually contributing to society by keeping the wheels of industry turning, and also by paying your taxes for social workers and police and fire trucks and stuff like that. But what people are finding is that even if you go to college now, there's no guarantee of a job with 40% of recent graduates unemployed. And even if you get a job for a corporation, there's no guarantee of health care or retirement benefits, because so many of us are expected to work as freelancers. Not only that, but if you do get to succeed at that stuff, you can't escape the feeling that you're kind of probably doing it a little bit at the expense of the world, because most of us don't believe in the missions of the corporations that we work for and feel as though they're actually doing a lot of harm in the world. So the question becomes, well, if those old standard approaches to life aren't working, what is the standard? What is a new approach to life? And is there a way where we can live happier and do better by the world. After No Impact Man, I traveled around and gave lectures, and what I found myself meeting thousands of what I call life questers. That's a term I made up, life questers. And what these life questers are doing is questing after a way of life that's both better for them and better for their world, for the world. And, you know, people are doing all sorts of things. They may be farming or running community gardens or starting elder centers or staying in their existing jobs but finding ways to be more helpful in their jobs. This book is about, it's about the quest for a way of life that's better for us and better for the world.
I think that's very well said. We're speaking with Colin Bevan, the author of No Impact Man and the recent book, How to Be Alive, A Guide to the Kind of Happiness That Helps the World. You actually tell a story in the book in this regard, Colin, about a college graduate who's enjoyed summer volunteer work for a good cause and sadly considers himself doomed to not enjoying work ever again until after retirement because he wants to support a family. But he is at least a teeny bit right, isn't he, that it takes a little more to support a family than a single person?
Yes, but the story of that young man that you talk about was that he had actually found his own passion, and he had found what talents he liked using. Let's take a step back. What he was doing was he was delivering secondhand books to underprivileged kids on his bicycle, and he really loved this job. He loved everything about it, that he was helping kids with their education, that he was part of the secondhand economy, that he was biking. He kind of found a place that, a way of being that made him happy. And then, as the story goes, he told me about this, and he was very sad because he believed he had to go on to get an MBA and that he would have to fit himself into this kind of standard life approach mold that we talked about before. And it was really sad because he kind of knew what he wanted to do with his life, and he resigned himself to the idea that he wouldn't be able to do it again until he was retired. He felt that he had to earn a lot of money as a business person to support a family and that he didn't even have yet. And the truth of the matter is that it's possible for us to find ways of living where our expenses are lower, for example, by living in community or living close to where we work, so we don't have to have cars driving around all the time. What it's possible to build life in a different way, and even if you've already built a life that where you feel stuck, it's possible to take small steps in that life to move towards a life that's more in line with your values.
Yeah, I think that's very helpful that the book suggests major and minor steps that one can take. Many years ago, I tried writing for newspapers, and I had to toe a corporate line, and I had to write things I absolutely disagreed with, and I quit with, no job prospects because it wasn't fulfilling. And I figured out, many years ago that I have to write for activist groups and non-corporate publications where I can feel like I'm trying to make the world a better place. But I can barely find enough work, even after many years of doing this. How can I recommend it to other people? I mean, if you want to go work in the weapons industry, there's plenty of jobs. If you want to go into the military, I mean, you can't avoid the recruitment advertisements. But if you want to work for peace, I mean, the LGBTQ rights campaign is a wonderful example of fast progress, but the plutocracy has really no interest against it. It's not up against those kind of forces. How do I tell someone who wants to work as a peace activist that they can get paid doing it?
You can't get paid. The truth is you cannot get paid as much working as a peace activist, chances are, as you could working in the weapons industry. But the truth also is that there are people out there who want to live according to materialistic values, and that's enough for them. But there are many of us, these burgeoning life questers, people it sounds like you and me, who actually have different sorts of values that we want to live by, and we may have to sacrifice that we're not going to be rich. But chances are we're going to have enough money to get by. And all the research, if we're hard workers and we're pursuing things, all the research shows that once you have enough money to get by, having more money doesn't actually increase your happiness. What does increase your happiness is the research shows there's actually three things that three psychological needs that we have. One is that we get to be what they call autonomous. That is to say that we're the author of our own actions. We are being the person that we want to be. The second is that we feel as though we're competent. That is that when we do be the person that we feel we're supposed to be, that we actually feel as though we have some effect. And then the third thing is relatedness, that what we do and who we are matters to people around us. So when you take all that together, it shows that our psychological, what makes us happiest is to meet the psychological need to be ourselves in service of our community. Now, and no amount of income can actually buy you that. So the question is not should you sacrifice yourself for the world. The question is how do you actually build a life according to your own values? That's the real question here. It's not about telling people to do something that they don't want to do, but there are so many of us who do feel this dis-ease and do want to live according to our values, and that's what this book is. That's the group of people this book is really for.
I suspect, Colin, you're going to say yes to this, and I suspect you're right. But if you set aside all the evils of extreme materialism and you find a more fulfilling life, can you be just as happy? Because I had an ethics professor on this show who said that if you really want to be moral, I mean, you really look into morality and do what you really ought to do, you pretty much have to give everything away, and you can't avoid suffering. It's going to be hard. Is he right?
Well, I don't really think that much about ethics and morality. I more think about returning to self, and when I say self, I mean with a big capital S. Like, what was I born to do? How was I born to live? Who am I? What can I do to live a life where I don't have regrets on my deathbed? And that doesn't mean that we have to give everything away or sacrifice everything. It means that we have to find some sort of balance. It turns out that if you do want to do good by the world, you need to not be distracted by your own insecurity, if I mean physical insecurity. So if you're not taking care of yourself in terms of making enough income to make sure that you can eat and keep a comfortable roof over your head, then chances are you're going to be so distracted by your own suffering you can't help the world anyway. So it's not about this kind of ethics and morality here. It's about actually asking why am I alive? Why was I born? And not about absolutely not about doing what we ought to do, but doing what we feel compelled to do by the people we act, by the persons we actually are.
Hoping that no persons are actually, driven to fulfill themselves by being Donald Trump, I suppose. What if our country had free health care and education and mass transit and affordable housing or even a guaranteed income? I mean, how much easier would it be for life questers? Have you looked at people who are attempting to find these sorts of fulfilling lives in Scandinavia, for example, and how different is it?
Let me take a step back to what you said when I said we want to kind of fulfill ourselves, and you said presupposing that we don't want to be like Donald Trump, of course. The truth of the matter is that it turns out that the psychology says that if we are not traumatized as we grow up, and if we are not severely taught to follow materialistic values, then when we actually return to our own inner values, what I call returning to the self, then the truth of the matter is we'll. The science shows because of those three needs, the autonomy, the competence, and the relatedness, we will actually help other people. So there's this idea about being yourself being a narcissistic thing.
Right.
But actually, most narcissists are following directions. They're doing whatever it takes to make people think that they're great, and they're following all everybody else's directions. That this is to be really in touch with yourself actually means to be in touch with your compassion. So it's important to say that. When, with regards to what you asked about systems being in place to actually allow us to fulfill our human purpose, when my little girl, I used to say to her sometimes, I'd say, hey, it was a little routine we had. I would say, hey, why are we alive, Bella? And she would say, to laugh, Daddy. And I would say, and what's our responsibility? And she would say, to make sure other people can laugh too. It was a great party trick to get my six-year-old to say that. But also, that's kind of what the life of the life cluster is about. Like, what's important to you? Let's say it's to laugh, or let's say it's to eat good food. And then what's your responsibility? Your responsibility is to help make it so other people have access to that too. So your question about, you know, are there systems in which we can live more according to our purpose? Yes, there are. But part of our, but what I believe part of the life quester's purpose is to make the systems we live in better for other people too, more accessible, so that the things that we care about are accessible to all.
Yeah. You bring up children, and that's a whole section of the book. You have a little girl. I have two boys who I love and want a better world for. I have a friend, a journalist I respect, named Dar Jamal, who's been looking at the future of the climate and the planet, and really advises everyone against having any kids because the future of the Earth is so bleak. How do you address that argument?
I don't go that route at all. The truth is that for some of us, having children is the most important life-fulfilling thing we could possibly do. I think that we have a responsibility to measure carefully whether we want to have children and how many children we want, and to actually ask ourselves, is it truly in line with my own purpose to do this, or am I doing it because my parents tell me I should be doing it? But if it's truly in line with your purpose, then go for it. But if it's also truly, part of what I do and try to do in the book is give permission to people to not have children. And what I suggest is that the people who feel that it's their destiny to have children, and the people who feel it's their destiny to not have children, should actually work together, so that the people who have children are supported by the people who don't have children, and the people who don't have children get to have the fulfilling relationships with other people's children. So that actually, I mean, it's not a new idea. It's just like we should support each other, and like we, you know, as we used to in the old days, but and should again in the future. So I don't say tell people not to have kids. I say choose carefully and wisely, and then if you do have kids, share them. And if you don't, because there's also 18 million young adults in this country who are at risk because they don't have enough adult contact. So if you choose to have kids, share them. If you choose not to have kids, help with other people's kids.
Yeah, I think it's a great point that people have a need for parenting, which you can fulfill without actually literally being a parent. There's a lot in the book, in fact, about relationships and family and friends, and it almost seems geared towards being an extrovert. I mean, do you have to, if you're an introverted person who thinks they need a lot of time alone, do you kind of have to become more of an extrovert to have a fulfilling life?
No, I don't think that so at all. Just to say what you're talking about, where I talk about the importance of building up an interconnected personal community.
Yeah.
You know, in our culture, the standard life approach is the most important thing is your romantic relationship. You have to find the best romantic relationship. And we forget about actually having friends and other forms of connection, which in many cases can be more predictive of our happiness and our success than the romantic relationship. In the book, I talk about building personal community, which means interconnection. And introverts, as much as extroverts, need to be connected. They also need time alone, and they also need not to be. They may need to not be center of attention when they're in amongst their extroverted friends. But the connection itself is important to all of us.
It's a wonderful book. I cannot recommend it highly enough to people. We have just a couple minutes left. What are easy steps people can take to get started, short of finding new relationships and community and employment and so forth?
Most of us have something in the world that's niggled us. Like I tell a story in the book about a woman called Anne who just, for some reason, the fact that she drank coffee and knowing that the world coffee trade causes a lot of environmental and social damage bothered her. And so finally, one day, she went to the grocery store, and she decided she was going to look for the most ethically produced coffee she could. She didn't know anything about it. She just looked and saw that there were certain labels, and one coffee had a bunch of certifications, and she decided to buy that. And it's not that is going to change the world, but she didn't stop there. She then went on to actually research more about it, and she found out about this thing called direct trade coffee houses, where coffee house owners actually work with small farmers, and they don't have to get the certification, and they work together to produce the coffee ethically. And she started going to that coffee shop, and then she became friends with the baristas, and they were part of a community garden, and she became part of that. Before you know it, she was on a climate march. So just from taking that small step of buying her coffee differently, it actually led to much more. So what's the one thing that you can do in 15 minutes today that will actually answer that niggle that you've been having about something you wish you could do differently about the world? And take that one step for the 15 minutes, and then take the next step for 15 minutes tomorrow, and just use that method to begin to experiment with living a life according to your values.
Yeah, share this radio show with someone. Then take a little bit bigger step than that, and a bigger one, and a bigger one. We're almost out of time. Let me ask you quickly about the single little tiny item that I actually disagreed with in the book. Page 165, I should thank a veteran today. What in the world should I thank a veteran for?
Oh, you know, veterans are I would say if there's a veteran in this country, when I was young, I used to pray for the end of the draft. And now that we have no draft, I realize that the whole reason we were able to go to Iraq and Afghanistan and be in war is because all we would do is send away the poor kids. The poor kids that had no access to college by any other means, that actually needed to be in the military as the only way they could get ahead in life.
So can we apologize to them instead of thanking them?
Why not do both?
Because I don't know what to thank them for. What am I thanking them for in 30 seconds?
I would thank them for their sacrifice, because whether you like what they did or not, they sacrificed to this system that's not working. Like those of us who are privileged enough not to have to go to war to run our lives, it's partly because of the people who aren't privileged enough not to go.
Unless we don't have the wars and nobody has to go. The book.
It'd be better not to have the wars. We're on board with that.
All right, we agree on that point and many others. And this is an incredible book. You need to pick up a copy. It is called How to Be Alive, A Guide to the Kind of Happiness That Helps the World by Colin Bevan. Colin, thanks for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
It was great to talk to you. Thanks for having me.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Countersmith.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, now everyone is very upset at the state-made disaster that is the poisoning of Flint, Michigan's water supply. Some children in the largely poor, largely black community have seen lead levels in their blood triple since the decision to take city tap water from the Flint River. But how that decision came to be made is fodder for more than the brief moment of sunlight corporate media generally afford. What are some of the questions journalists could draw from Flint's experience and apply going forward? Chris Savage is owner and publisher of the Michigan-based eclectablog.com, where he's been tracking the story. We'll have an extended interview with him coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a quick look back at recent press. Great Britain won't actually ban Donald Trump from the country, but Parliament did spend time taking seriously what was called Trump's poisonous, corrosive effect on public discourse. At the same time, actors, writers, and others, including Harry Belafonte, Eve Ensler, and Noam Chomsky, launched a Stop Hate, Dump Trump campaign that included serving notice to media that they, quote, are accountable for normalizing Trump's extremism by treating it as entertainment, by giving it inordinate and unequal airtime, and by refusing to investigate, interrogate, or condemn it appropriately, close quote. For some journalists, this all might provoke questions. Reporters can't ignore public figures, but is there daylight between covering news of a person and providing them a near-constant legitimizing megaphone? For media executives, though, the main question seems to be, what time does the bank open? I'm thinking of a report from December by Lee Fang at The Intercept about how, with visions of campaign ad dollars sparkling in his eye, CBS chief executive Les Moonves cheered on Trump's candidacy at an investor presentation. Quote, "The more they spend, the better it is for us. And go, Donald. Keep getting out there." Close quote. This was after Trump's comments about Mexico sending rapists to the U.S. and calling for Muslim Americans to have to register with the government. In an earlier investor meeting, Moonves had joked, quote, "Looking ahead, the 2016 presidential election is right around the corner, and thank God the rancor has already begun," close quote. The same media companies that, behind the scenes, cheerfully acknowledge a preference for rancor or extremism if it keeps candidates spending money, and lobby furiously against campaign finance reforms that might interrupt their cash flow, also, Fang reminds us, present themselves at the same time as neutral observers of the electoral process. Well, Les Moonves may have said, quote, "This is fun, watching this. Let them spend money on us. We're looking forward to a very exciting political year in 16, close quote. But that doesn't mean that media companies see green over red or blue. They don't care only about profit-making, but about maintaining the policies and laws that protect that profit-making. Which may be why, when asked about electoral politics by Time magazine in 2004, Sumner Redstone, executive chair of CBS and Viacom, said that while then-Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry was a good man and a friend, quote, "Viacom is my life, and I do believe that a Republican administration is better for media companies than a Democratic one," close quote. And I was reminded of that while reading a Washington Post hot take of January 18th, headlined, most of Bernie Sanders' big ideas are dead on arrival in Congress. Do Democrats care? Close quote. Well, the idea, you won't be surprised to hear, is that the divergence between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders on health care is about head versus heart. Because while Clinton is being realistic, Sanders' call for single-payer health care, while making for an arguably more exciting candidacy, is downright impossible. Clinton's, quote, attempt to bat down hopes about his universal health care plan becoming law was one of her most forceful arguments against his candidacy, close quote, writes the Post's Amber Phillips. But, quote, being the voice of reason in this polarized election cycle isn't easy, close quote. For gatekeeper media, it doesn't matter that single payer is and has been for decades what the U.S. public, faced with heartbreaking choices about their and their loved ones' health, overwhelmingly wants. The savvy thing is to dismiss the public will as politically impossible, without ever taking a beat to wonder whether that should not be cause for alarm, much less whether media's incessant repeating of the idea might not be a big part of what makes it so. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Representing some of the insult added to the grievous injury inflicted on people of Flint, Michigan, whose water was poisoned with lead, a video explaining how to install a lead-reducing filter that pointed out that those filters were distributed, quote, at no charge to the citizens of Flint by the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services, close quote. Well, money is in many ways at the core of this story of man-made disaster in Flint, but it's also a story about democracy. Our next guest has been following the events closely. Chris Savage is owner publisher of the news and commentary site eclectablog.com, tracking Michigan and national politics. He joins us now by phone from Dexter, Michigan. Welcome to Counterspin, Chris Savage.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Well, there is a painful irony that when many are to blame for a problem, sometimes that means no one is held accountable. Let's start to peel the onion here. Decisions were made in 2014 about water sourcing, but why those decisions were made, by whom, the way those decisions were made, that has its roots in earlier events. If you had to isolate some of the key moments that brought us to where we are today, what would those be? Where would that start?
Well, the whole thing really began in 2013. Prior to that, Flint had been considering changing where it got its water. It was at the time getting its water from the city of Detroit through their Detroit Water and Sewerage Department. They had a nearly 50-year contract with them. However, the water was very expensive. So they have some of the highest water costs in the country, actually, in Flint, Michigan. They joined up with other regional concerns like Genesee County and other groups around the area, and decided to form what was called the Karagandhi Water Authority, and they're building a pipeline and a water treatment plant to provide their own water rather than purchasing it from Detroit. That happened in April of 2013. Several days after they did that, the Detroit Water and Sewerage Department exercised its option to cancel their current contract with the city of Flint, which meant they had to give 1 year advance notice. This was done, by the way, with Detroit being under an emergency manager as well. So both cities were actually under the control of emergency managers at the time who were making all of the decisions for the local government. So what transpired in the following year was that Flint had to make some decisions about where they're going to get their water or if they were going to renegotiate their contract with Detroit. Just prior to when Detroit's contract ended with them in April of 2014, the Detroit Sewer and Water Department sent Darnell Early, who was at the time the Flint emergency manager, a letter saying you can stay on our system and you're not being kicked off, but they were going to renegotiate the contract. And of course, because of this, their water rates were going to go even higher. And I find some brutal irony in this that both cities were under emergency managers, and yet you have one city basically exploiting the other city for higher water costs.
Right.
So Darnell Early at that point just sent them a letter back saying thanks, but no thanks. He had made the decision they were going to go to the Flint River. And in April of 2014, that is when that happened. And that really was the fateful decision, that decision not to remain on Detroit water, but to switch to the Flint River in the interim while the Karagandhi pipeline was being completed, and it will not be completed until the summer. So for about a year and a half, they were going to have to pay exorbitant rates to Detroit, and he decided to go to the Flint River. And this, I should say, is the idea that, you know, they would go to Flint had been considered in the past, and a report was sent to the state of Michigan in 2013 telling them that going to the Flint River would require considerably more water treatment, including phosphate treatments to prevent the mineral scale and biofilm on the insides of people's pipes from being eroded away and revealing the lead solder underneath. And it's that lead solder in the pipelines going from the main water line in the streets to people's homes that is the source of the lead in people's drinking water.
Well, if I can just reprise briefly the political part of that. Flint ended their contract with the Detroit water system because they were building a new one. But in the interim, they could have continued getting water. Before that new pipeline came online, they needed to get water from somewhere. They had the option of continuing on with Detroit at higher prices or going to Flint. And the irony or whatever is that these are two cities under emergency managers, and they're basically having, you called it a pissing match. You know, these two emergency managers are saying, well, sure, you can use our water because you can't get your new Lake Huron water yet, but you've got to do it at these rates. And these are both, I mean, they're emergency managers for a reason, supposedly because they're trying to save these communities money.
Theoretically, yes. And that's accurate except for one thing, and that is that Detroit was the one that made the decision to end that that contract. It was not Flint. Flint had intended to stay on their system until they flipped the switch over to their new pipeline. It was Detroit that said, you know, you're going to be cut off in a year unless you renegotiate the contract.
Then when the problems start to happen, when the water is switched to the Flint River as a source and the anticipated, as you note, problems start to come up, then we talk about response from the governor's office. Governor Rick Snyder is aware that problems are being reported and does not nothing, but something somehow worse than nothing.
Yes, they made the switch in April 2014. Almost immediately, people in Flint began to report just disgustingly discolored water coming from their taps. Water smelled foul. People were getting rashes. People were getting sick. They found that there was high levels of E. coli, so there was a boil water alert for some time. They began treating with chlorine to fix that problem. And because of the overtreatment with chlorine, they started creating trihalomethanes, which are a byproduct of disinfection. They exceeded the Clean Water Act regulations on those. That had to be treated. So they had a lot of problems before the lead issue manifested itself. It took a while for that water of the Flint River, which is more corrosive than the Detroit River, to sort of erode away this coating that's on the inside of these pipelines. And it was basically around January of 2015 that the lead problem started to become manifest. Reports that were being sent to Michigan's Department of Environmental Quality, which is in charge of approving all water treatment plans for municipalities, they had been doing testing according to guidelines, and they were using the guidelines incorrectly. They were supposed to be testing 100 different high-risk homes at the tap, and then if the lead level in the 90th percentile was above 15 parts per billion, then they were supposed to take action. This is required by federal law. They had only taken actually 72 samples, which they were supposed to take 100, and some of those had spiked pretty high, putting them into the action zone in the 90th percentile. And so people that were responsible for that reporting were instructed by DEQ to remove two of the samples, and that brought them down below the action level of 15 parts per billion, and so they could continue on without further treatment. The ironic part about this, and the really just disgusting part about this, is that phosphate treatment would have cost them about $60 per day to do. It was very inexpensive to do this phosphate treatment, which is very effective at maintaining that film that covers the lead and protects the water from being exposed to lead. But the DEQ signed off on the treatment that did not include the phosphate, and that's why the Snyder administration, Governor Snyder is our governor, and his administration is complicit in this because his department was the one that signed off on this treatment, lack of treatment, I should say, in terms of phosphate. So basically, Governor Snyder claims he didn't know about problems until October of last year. Reports of high lead really began to become manifest in the summer of last year. A couple of people in particular are sort of what I would consider to be heroes in this. One is Dr. Mona Hanum Atisha, who's a pediatrician at the Hurley's Children's Hospital, who began to test the blood levels of Flint children and seeing astonishingly high lead levels that can result in permanent damage to these kids. Because it goes into their bones, it can actually be passed on to their children as well. And the other is Mark Edwards, who's a civil engineering prof at Virginia Tech. He came up and began doing some water testing of his own, found extremely high levels all over the city of Flint, and he sort of blew the whistle on this. The U.S. EPA, during the summer last year, had been trying to get Flint to take some action. They have been criticized because they didn't make it public, that these are all internal discussions, and they probably do share some of the blame on this.
Right.
But the fact that all of this was happening and DEQ did know what was going on really puts the bullseye, in my opinion, or the crosshairs on the Snyder administration in terms of culpability.
Well, headlines like Newsweek magazine from October, Flint, the cheapskate city that poisoned its children, they certainly seem to be taking a tone of blaming local officials. What I'm hearing you say is that this really wasn't a decision made by local officials. It has everything to do with the state-appointed managers. So I'd like to ask you a little bit about the role of emergency managers and what that has meant in Michigan. Michigan has even a kind of turbocharged emergency management law. It's even different than other states. Tell us about that.
Emergency management began actually during Jim Blanchard's administration many years ago, three decades ago now, and continued under Jennifer Granholm. At that time, they were called emergency financial managers, and their responsibility was to come into cities that were facing financial crises and try to get control over their costs and their revenues and that type of thing. It was when the Snyder administration came in 2011 that things really changed. They passed what became Public Act 4, and the name changed from emergency financial managers to emergency managers. They removed the word financial. And there's a reason for that. Partly it's because school emergency managers were then allowed to dabble in things like curriculum, and these are not necessarily trained educators. So that was very disturbing to a lot of people who are involved in the education realm. But they also did things like allow them to renegotiate or cancel contracts with unions and things like that. And that was something that was not in their arsenal of tools, if you want to call it that, prior to that. Essentially, what happened with emergency managers is that they replaced the local elected officials. They were actually able to fire local elected officials if they chose to do so and replace them on their city councils or whatever the local governing body was. And that did happen in some cities. But it was basically an abridgment of democracy. It was taking away power from elected officials and handing it over to a single person who's appointed by the governor. And that person made all of the decisions. So this finger pointing at local officials is quite laughable, quite frankly, because these people really had no power. The emergency manager had the final say on everything. And that's why we're pointing the finger at people like Darnell Early and other people in the Snyder administration, because they literally ran the city. And, you know, you can't take control of a city and take credit for all of the things that happen that you consider to be good, but then shirk responsibility for any of the things that go horribly wrong. And in this case, this is really the most epically, horribly bad thing that could happen under an emergency manager is poisoning of the city's residents.
Well, Flint, as listeners know, was hit hard by deindustrialization. More than 40% of the residents earn below the federal poverty line.
Yeah.
It's also predominantly Black. And, you know, it's been noted that cities under emergency managers, as Chris Lewis in The Atlantic wrote it, cities under emergency managers contain just 9% of Michigan's population, but about half the state's African-American residents.
I was actually the person that broke that story, to be honest with you. You know, when I did the calculations, once Detroit got an emergency manager, literally over half of the African-Americans did not have locally elected Democratic government. It's a shocking statistic, frankly.
Well, I appreciate that because that is, it's still kind of on the back burner in terms of coverage of this story, but it seems important. It's hard to miss that this anti-democratic method is being carried out in a place and in places that, number one, the state is already disinvested from, you know, and then, as you've just said, that it's overwhelmingly African Americans who are being deprived of political rights.
That's right. And the people who defend emergency management will point to, you know, corruption and malfeasance and incompetence in these areas. And their position is that emergency managers are needed to sort of cut through all of this corruption and incompetence and make hard decisions that local officials are incapable of making. But there's a few things wrong with that. One is that local officials don't have the ability to do some of the things that emergency managers are capable of doing, like forcing unions to renegotiate their contracts. But it also forces people to, you know, have to, they don't have constituents anymore. I mean, these emergency managers are only responsible to the state. And they're only armed with tools of what I call destruction instead of construction and renewal. They're not able to do things that will increase revenues, for example, in cities. They can only cut costs, and that's where corners get cut, and that's where things happen. So that's why we see a lot of privatization happening, and we see union contracts being broken, and this idea that they've come in and replaced all this corruption and incompetence is being put to lie by the fact that many of these cities have been under emergency managers for many years. They have been under emergency managers in some cases, like Flint, more than once. And in the cases of Detroit Public Schools, that's been under an emergency manager for many years, they have a bigger budget deficit now than they have ever had. It's almost $500 million. So it's very clear that this emergency management concept just does not work. Yeah. You know, they are not fixing these problems. And it just shows you that the problems are not related to corruption and incompetence, at least in all cases, but rather it's due to their circumstances. And like you say, it's this investment, it's the collapse of the automotive industry in Michigan. If you look at these cities, most of them are former automotive cities or cities that had a major industry that left. So, for example, in Benton Harbor, you know, they had a flight of local jobs because of plants closing. When you crater an urban center because you remove the jobs, you're left with a population that still has all of the same needs from its government, things like water and, you know, fire protection and law enforcement, things like that. But they're operating on a budget that is just dramatically reduced.
Right.
These are not things that you can fix by cutting costs and by renegotiating union contracts. They require investment, they require urban renewal, and they require us to build these cities back up to what they were at one time.
Well, what can you do but laugh about the fact that Rick Snyder now says he wants to give Flint back to local control,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's a little ironic that, you know, they've created this giant catastrophe in Flint, and now all of a sudden he wants to return control to the local mayor.
Well, Rick Snyder is now releasing his emails, and they're showing that they were dismissive of critics. Certainly, we saw that in a story yesterday.
Indeed.
But do you think there are really any substantive surprises to be found there? Do we need more information? I'm sure it will shed light, but are we really missing the key ingredients to move forward with trying to fix this?
One of the striking things about the emails that he released is that they're only for 2014 and 2015. And as I described earlier, many of the decisions that were made that led up to this catastrophe in Flint were in 2013. And he's also not requiring his staffers and other administrators to release their emails as well. And so we really don't know the full story. And a lot of the decisions that got made happened before 2014. So there's still quite a hue and cry over this. And the reason for this is because Michigan is one of just a handful of states that shields the governor from FOIA requests. So he did this email release voluntarily, but he was politically forced to do that, I think, because of the national and international attention that's been focused on this. But he was not by law compelled to do that.
Right.
And I do give a lot of credit to our local media. I don't always do that, Janine, but the Detroit Free Press, the Detroit News, MLive, these organizations have done a very good job over the last couple of years in sort of following the story and making sure that people knew what was going on. In an interesting turn, the ACLU actually hired an investigative journalist, Kurt Guyette, and he's done a lot of the FOIA work and has revealed a lot of the information that we have today that has shined the light on the Snyder administration and the ways that they have so tragically failed the Flint residents.
Well, we are very grateful to see that media attention now, and it's obviously very much to the credit of local reporters that they created a baseline of information so that now that national and even international media come in, there's work, you know, they can trace the story back. There are some media tendencies that concern me. I just want to ask you finally is that, you know, there's a tendency, as I said earlier, to say, oh, there's a whole lot of blame to go around here, and that kind of ends up sort of frittering away to nothing. I mean, when you hear about people being charging people with politicizing the scandal, I think that's just surreal. I mean, it is a political scandal. But I wanted to move you on to the protests and what people are doing, because we know that people aren't motivated by bloodlust. They just think people have to pay for this or there'll be no downside to these decisions and it'll just be
that's kind of
a furor and nothing will come of it. So what's been going on protest-wise and what are people calling for?
We had a very big protest on the Capitol steps, well, actually across the street from the Capitol, Lansing City Hall on Tuesday. After the press conference was over, they all headed over to the Capitol where the State of the State address was being given by Governor Snyder. They were loud enough that you could actually hear them. If you were watching it on television, you could actually hear the protesters in the background.
Great.
On the television broadcast. That created a lot of tension, of course. There was a protest at Governor Snyder's $2 million condo in downtown Ann Arbor the day prior to that. And then over the weekend in Flint, there were a couple of protests there as well, with Jesse Jackson coming to shine some light on it and to bring some attention. There are also some lawsuits involved. There are at least three, possibly four lawsuits going on right now. Back in August, a class action suit was filed that was related to the cost of Flint water. The thing to keep in mind is that throughout this entire thing, while people were not able to use their water, they were still getting the highest bills in the country for
That's
their water. In some
crazy.
Cases, several hundred dollars a month, $800 a month in one case.
For this water that was poisoning
that them. You couldn't drink. That's right. You couldn't use it for what it was intended. This past week, there were two more class action suits filed, one requiring the state to take responsibility for the water payments and to reimburse these people who have been charged exorbitant fees, and in some cases had their water shut off for not paying those fees. And then the second one was filed to hold the state liable for the things that they've done in terms of poisoning their own residents. There are massive water drives happening all over the state, of course. The labor unions have really kicked in big. They've been delivering semi-trucks full of water, and that will continue for some time, I think, until the water again is once again safe to drink in Flint.
Let me ask you finally and briefly what you would say to journalists who are aware that the story is going to be a big story this week, but they've got to continue to keep their eyes on it, right? Because some of this is not going to happen for weeks or months or maybe years.
That's absolutely right. And this is also a problem that probably other cities face as well. It only became manifest in Flint because of the change in the water source, but there are many homes in Michigan as well as across the country, and particularly in cities that have older homes and things like this where lead solder was used for many years. This is a problem that we face and needs to be addressed. But I also just would ask that journalists dig a little deeper. There's plenty of evidence out there that this decision was made by an emergency manager and by the state of Michigan. Final sign-off, for example, on the Flint River switch, we find out from the emails that were released yesterday, came from the state treasurer who was in charge of the emergency managers. It's far too simplistic to just blame the local officials on this. They didn't have the local control and the ability to make these decisions. And the Flint City Council never once voted to go to the Flint River. That was a decision that was signed off on by the emergency manager and by the state treasurer. So let's get the facts out there straight. You know, there are, like you say, plenty of people that have dropped the ball on this, but at some point the buck has to stop. And I hope that Governor Snyder's statement that he apologizes and is going to make this right, I hope he does do that. But this is going to require over $1 billion probably in Flint to rectify. And, you know, we've got to find that money. And my biggest fear really is that it will come from other things that we value, like education.
We've been speaking with Chris Savage. You can find his work on this as well as other issues online at eclectablog.com. Chris Savage, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks, Janine. It's been a pleasure.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. FAIR also publishes a magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can go to our website. It's fair.org. Counterspin is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
It sounds impossible. An expert with decades of experience says global warming between 4 to 6 degrees could lead to mass die-off of the plankton that produces up to 70% of the world's oxygen. Forget rising seas, Sergei Petrovsky says. We are more likely to stifle than drown. I'll also be talking with the Canadian campaigner who got climate warning stickers put on gas pumps, and he hopes to take that global. But first, we're going to visit with an economic anthropologist and one of Sweden's leading thinkers on the economy, money, and climate change. Alf Hornberg is hoping the next economic crisis can help us change. Is it happening now? I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio Eco Shock. Imagine technology as a system that gathers up days of people's lives, mixes them with nature, physical things and living things, and then channels products towards a minority, in fact, to a dwindling number of the wealthy elite. All the while, the same technology reduces our chances for survival. I think that's how the Swedish author and anthropologist Alf Hornberg sees it, but only he can say. Let's ask him. Professor Alf Hornberg, welcome to Radio Eco Shock.
Thank you, Alex.
Now, most of us think of technology as good ideas, more tools to enable an easier or richer life. What's wrong with our wonderful world of cars, dishwashers, and cell phones?
Right. Well, the notion that technology is basically about ingenious ideas is, I think, erroneous. And it goes, you know, a couple of centuries back in time, or rather it's been erroneous for that time. I would argue that up until the Industrial Revolution, it was largely correct. I mean, inventions and technologies were about people who figured out new practical ways of doing things. But beginning with the Industrial Revolution, say in the late 18th century, there was a second set of circumstances that was absolutely crucial for a technology to exist at all. And not only engineering knowledge, but also the social rates of exchange of resources and labor on the world market, what I would call the world system. So differences in prices, for example, raw cotton from the cotton plantations in the U.S. versus the prices of cotton textiles produced in the U.K., these exchange relations were crucial for the very existence of technology. I would put it very drastically by saying, for example, that the steam engine would not have existed without the slave plantations in southeastern United States.
Well, now it seems everyone from greens to super capitalists are looking for the next technology that will save us from technology. Are there other options?
Yeah. First of all, I just want to say you're absolutely right. This is one of the most difficult things to sort of deconstruct, this belief in technological progress, because everybody, regardless of ideological color, subscribes to it. Everybody believes that there will be a new technology that will make us sustainable and so on. My fundamental argument is that we should not be looking for new technological solutions. We should be looking at money. We should be looking at the economy as the problem that both generates these unsustainable and inequitable technologies and destroys our environment. We should be thinking in terms of how our ideas on money and the economy can be changed instead.
Well, right. Speaking in Paris a couple of years ago, you suggested only an economic crisis would open doorways for meaningful change at the political level. And it looks like we're entering another crisis now. Does that give you more hope?
Well, I must admit that I felt quite a lot of hope around 2008. There was a lot of talk of a global financial crisis, and I was wondering if this might, in fact, shape a new kind of political discussion, dialogue about the role of the economy in human society and the biosphere and so on. But now, I mean, this year, 2016, 8 years will have passed, and I don't see any major changes, really. So I think it will require more of a crisis, a more fundamental crisis, to make it feasible to talk about these things in a more detached way. I think we're way too comfortable yet, at least in Europe and North America, to really, really start rethinking what modern civilization is all about and technology is all about.
I totally agree with you. But I did notice after the shock of 2008 that a few communities started local currencies, or at least barter dollars. Could an alternative currency actually help reduce carbon emissions?
Yes, I'm quite convinced that that's the way to approach it. But I've been looking at the great number of experiments with alternative currencies that have been conducted over the past 30 or 40 years, actually. The so-called LETS economies, local exchange trading systems, and you have Ithaca hours, you have Bristol pounds, you have a number of different kinds of community currencies, alternative currency schemes, and I do think that they suffer from certain, you know, they have certain problems, and one of them is that they're generally initiated from the grassroots level, which sounds democratic and nice, but which means that they are generally, they're sort of antagonistic vis-a-vis the establishment, which generally means that they are marginalized and they survive only as long as a few enthusiasts manage to keep their energy up. I mean, if they rely on local people's enthusiasm, then they're doomed. We need a system that really is backed up by the authorities and that will continue regardless of individual enthusiasm. And I think the other thing that is I would like to see changed in these initiatives is that the currency, I would call it a complementary currency, because it would exist alongside the formal general currency. But this complementary currency needs to specify what kinds of goods and services it can be exchanged for. And to my mind, it would be important to relocalize the economy by saying that this complementary currency can be used only to buy goods and services that have been produced within a certain radius geographically of the point of purchase. It could be 30 kilometers or 50 kilometers. That's not that important. But the important thing is to have this complementary currency distinguishing between locally produced goods and services on the one hand and what is being sold on the globalized market on the other.
Well, I guess it goes without saying if we have local economies, we're not shipping things long distance using fossil fuels, and there's a greater chance we're not abusing someone else's rights by hiring dirt cheap labor. I want to get on to climate change. Do you see that as another big problem for humanity, or is it the ultimate threat to survival?
Oh, absolutely. It is the ultimate threat, and I understand completely that why it engages millions of people all over the world and why we have these enormous conferences. People are seriously worried, and they have every reason to be worried about climate change.
Alf Hornberg, you became more widely known after your 2001 book, The Power of the Machine. This year you will publish another titled Global Magic. I realize I'm about to ask a huge question, but can you give us a couple of examples of the way your thinking has evolved in the last 15 years?
Yeah, one of the examples I would give has to do with the distinction that I have often been asked to make between magic and technology. And I've found it analytically challenging and difficult to pin down exactly what I mean about machine fetishism, which is a concept that implies that technology is really a version, a modern version of magic. And actually, just last year, I came up with a very concrete example to illustrate what I'm saying. And my point of departure is to compare coins and keys. Now, coins and keys are little pieces of metal. And according to what is known as actor network theory, and people who theorize about how objects and artifacts are given agency, how they actually intervene in social processes, humans delegate agency to things, to artifacts, to the things they make. And this is true for both coins and keys, I would argue. We delegate, we let the coins and the keys act, so to speak. They have social impacts. But there's a crucial difference between coins and keys, and this is what I really would like to emphasize. The agency of coins is contingent on what humans believe about them, about their subjective ideas. Money would not have any agency if we did not believe that money was valuable, whereas keys have agency. They turn a lock simply because of the way they're physically designed, not because of what humans believe about them. And I would argue that this simple distinction is what distinguishes magic from technology. And I would argue, actually, as a corollary, that very much of modern technology somewhere along the line is contingent on human beliefs. So I would argue in that sense, it is a version of magic.
We talked about money, but the real underpinnings of our financial system seem to remain off limits and mysterious. I mean, scientists are allowed to study natural systems in tremendous detail, how sea creatures reproduce and so on. But who really owns what is a secret matter for private banks and private corporations, even if they threaten to ruin the natural world. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I agree with your understanding of finance completely. And I do think that finance is actually the point where magic enters the picture. I think after 2008 and the financial crisis, most of us have become aware of the fact that there's a kind of a magic about money. I mean, for us here in Europe, it's pretty amazing to hear that the U.S. in just the last couple of years or so has become a major exporter of fossil fuels again. And you wonder how is this possible? You know, we thought, speaking of net energy and so on, we thought that U.S. had to go to war in the Middle East to secure its oil imports, and here we're hearing no, the U.S. can fix its own oil at this point. And the more we think about it, of course, we realize that this would be impossible without finance, that it's actually what goes on Wall Street and other contexts like that that makes it possible to pump oil out of the U.S. and run technology on it. So finance, the magic of money, is actually making American oil an active material component in the economy. Finance underwrites the agency, the material agency of oil. And that goes to show how magic actually intervenes, impinges, and becomes fundamental to technology.
But if we stop believing that, we're told, if we try and change the rules of the game, it's all going to fall apart and we'll all starve in the dark in our cities. How do we manage to rationalize and become so blind to these things?
Yeah, I think we have a lot to learn about how human perceptions and worldviews actually intervene in very tangible ways in the way we organize global society, technologically, economically. We can no longer believe that the physical world, the material world, and the world of human ideas are two separate parts of reality because they do intermingle. And what we have to do is to understand how this occurs, and we have to maintain, I think, importantly, an analytical distinction between the sort of the pre-human world, thermodynamics, gravity, the material world that we used to call nature on one hand, and all the kinds of social conventions and symbolic systems and ideas and so on that we develop in human societies. We have to maintain an analytical distinction to be able to say this is nature and this is society. But then, of course, we know that the nature and society are all the time intermingled in our bodies, in our landscapes, our technologies. They're always mixed up. But we should know what comes from nature and what comes from society. I think we shouldn't let go of that distinction.
Radio EcoShock.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, the Swedish author and anthropologist from Lund University, Alf Hernberg. Alf, picking up on what you just said, I interviewed the popular German journalist Christian Schwagerl about his book The Anthropocene, The Human Era and How It Shapes Our Planet. What dangers lurk in proclaiming this to be the new human age?
Yeah, a colleague and I actually published a little piece on this in the Anthropocene Review of the journal a couple of years ago, and it's been quite widely cited. The argument that we have advanced in that paper is that if we call this the age of humans, we're implying that it's humanity, an undifferentiated human species, that has created all the problems we have in the Anthropocene, climate change, and so on. Whereas my colleague and I would argue that it's historically a minority of the human species who have kind of propelled these changes by inaugurating the Industrial Revolution and consequently the Anthropocene. So we would prefer other denominations. I would personally prefer the technocene. I know my colleague Andreas Malm coined the concept capitalocene and so on. There are other words that would make it more clear that this is not humanity as a whole that has developed this new era. It's a small privileged elite who have actually driven these changes.
Okay, we started talking about technology, and people grudgingly admit money could be a root of evil, but certainly not technology. Are you suggesting we can unplug and walk away from the technomass we have created, and wouldn't billions of people die in short order if we did that?
I think very much would emerge sort of automatically out of a fundamental change of the economy. And I'm not at all convinced that sort of getting off the technology, so to speak, would put a lot of people in peril. In fact, I would argue the opposite. It would liberate people to start using the land and their labor time for more sustainable things than we're doing now. Actually, there is enough soil and other resources on this planet to support the population we have now without fossil fuels. In fact, if you want to be really drastic, another colleague of mine figured out that if everybody was a vegan, now, of course, we're not all vegans, but if all humans were vegans, there would be room for about 30 billion of us on this planet without cutting down one more tree and without fossil fuels. So really, I think that this myth that, you know, we have to have fossil fuels and modern technology in order to feed two of the world's 7-8 billion people, I think is a myth, definitely.
Okay. Another justification is the idea that the geographical locus of this collection machine, as you might call it, has an ability to shift over time. We think of the rise of Japan, Korea, and now China as centers of not just technology, but the accumulation of capital. The wealth might appear anywhere, we say. Or does technology always need that hinterland of slums and poverty somewhere else to function?
I think it does. I've published a few texts where I use the notion of the zero-sum world or a zero-sum game. I do think that technology is very much about saving time and space by some people at the expense of time and space lost by other people, so that what we think of as technological progress or growth or capital accumulation is really about developing capacities to liberate and save time and space, human time and natural space, in some sectors of the world system at the expense of other sectors where human time and natural space are lost and are in fact used to subsidize those gains that some of us with enough purchasing power make.
Alf Hernberg, what does economic anthropology tell us about climate change and our prospects of avoiding a climate catastrophe?
I'm not sure that economic anthropology in itself directly would respond to that, but there are perspectives from economic anthropology that I think could be applied. For example, our almost universal human concern with reciprocity. The classic, of course, is Marcel Mauss' book, The Gift, where he draws on a Maori informant who early in the 20th century says that if you receive a gift, you have to repay it somehow. And I think this can actually be applied to climate change. There's a lot of talk now about climate justice, and we know that portions of world population have been using much too large parts of the atmosphere as sinks for carbon dioxide at the expense of other populations who are suffering from more floods and droughts and so on than others. There's a kind of a reciprocity problem about climate and climate justice.
Yeah, so I guess it's a crass question, but all of us are asking ourselves inside, what would climate justice cost us? The average person in America or Scandinavia, what do we have to give up in order to get that?
Yeah, I wish I was good at remembering figures, but let's just put it this way, that in order for these changes to really materialize that people talked about in Paris when everybody was cheering about how we're now entering the post-fossil age and so on, if those changes would really materialize, it would require very, very much and a very, very radical change of lifestyle for most of us. I know that, for example, in Sweden, carbon dioxide emissions, not only from what we produce in Sweden, but if we include also the stuff we consume that has been produced, much of it in China, we have about emissions of about 12 tons of carbon per year per capita, which is about twice the formal statistics that say, like, okay, Sweden has about 5 or 6 tons per capita, but that's just production-based. And if we want to get down to, say, around 1 ton per capita, you can imagine that it would mean reducing our consumption levels to about 1/12 of where we are now. And we're talking that scale, so it's a major change for Europeans and Americans.
Yeah, personally, I think one idea is to get rid of the idea of new, that we have to buy everything new. There's already so many products in the world, too many cars already, all of that. I think we just have to start using used things. That's one answer. Well, you know, the cynic would say that words like justice and morality or ethics don't matter to enough people to change our course, but I have noticed a series of older people like you, myself, and James Hansen seem motivated partly by fear for our grandchildren's future. As an anthropologist, is that a viable driver for human action?
Yeah, it's a good question. As you say, I have grandchildren myself, and it makes me think a lot more about what this planet will look like 70 or 80 years from now. I think the concept of morality is very important in these discussions, in particular because modern neoclassical or neoliberal economics has a very special relation to morality that I think is problematic. I've often tried to test the concept of unequal exchange on economists, and they say, well, we never heard of it, really. We don't use that word. And I think the whole notion of unequal exchange, which is a moral concept, basically, the fact that it's not doesn't sort of ring a bell for economists. It tells you that morality is not their main point, you know, it's not their main issue. Their main issue is the mechanisms that determine prices on the world market. But what is actually being exchanged on the world market in terms of energy, matter, embodied labor, and so on, land, embodied land, is not as important as whether those price mechanisms operate the way they should, according to economists. So morality is a major issue, but to get back to your question, whether it's enough to really make us change our behavior, I cannot answer, and I certainly don't want to suggest that I personally am doing all that much for the world, except, you know, writing my books and getting engaged in the debates. I do think we need major decisions, structural decisions about the economy that need to be taken democratically in parliaments. I don't think we should be hoisting the burden onto individuals because we feel bad about the world as it is, and we have so little power as individuals. So I don't think it's really correct to let us carry the burden of guilt as well for what's happening.
Well, some people say we've been brainwashed by a powerful elite. I mean, there are mega corporations and the media are owned by just a few corporations, but that sort of lets us off the hook. And I wonder if it's true. I mean, is it the rest of us? When politicians say, well, look, I don't have the political support to make these changes, people want what they want. How can we answer that?
Mm. Yeah, well, so far we're just too comfortable in Europe and North America to really make drastic changes in our lives. But I do believe that crises of one kind or another, and perhaps in particular financial crises, could quickly change our readiness to change. So I think we may need some kind of push from the economy to really change our behavior. And people are apparently very versatile. I mean, we only need to recall in the 1930s, which was the last major economic depression. And as far as I understand, I wasn't around then, but as far as I understand, people very readily, you know, plowed up their lawns and planted potatoes and changed their lifestyle very quickly as an adjustment to the economic changes that they were experiencing. And I think that that's what we can probably hope for in the future as well.
Well, our time together has been too short. We can't possibly capture your long career of powerful ideas. Alf Hernberg has been one of the more difficult and rewarding guests that I have researched. You can find links to learn more yourself in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. We reached Alf at the prestigious Lund University in Sweden, where he has been a professor of human ecology since 1993. Thank you so much for sharing your time and ideas with us.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
You have heard that a warming world will flood coastal cities. Hotter seas will drive more extreme weather events. All that may not matter if a new paper on plankton is correct. The authors say if the ocean life that creates more than half the oxygen in the atmosphere dies off, we are more likely to stifle than drown. To understand this new threat, let's get to work. The paper is called Mathematical Modeling of Plankton Oxygen Dynamics Under the Climate Change. From the Department of Mathematics at the University of Leicester in Britain, we've reached the co-author Sergei Petrovsky. Sergei, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
Just to disturb our listeners a little bit, your peer-reviewed study suggests there is a tipping point in ocean heating that could drive plankton into extinction. Is that right?
Yes. I'm afraid our model shows it quite clearly.
Well, with something that big, we'd better start at the bottom. Most of us don't know where our oxygen comes from. What is plankton, really?
Plankton is a is a kind of generic term. Plankton applies to, well, almost everything that floats in the water, in the oceans. And usually it's divided into two large taxonomic groups, like phytoplankton, which are small aquatic plants, and zooplankton, which are small aquatic animals like shrimps or similar.
Could we see an individual species of plankton if we held just one in our hands?
I guess this is a kind of typical confusion. Plankton organisms are not necessarily small. So some of them can indeed be just a fraction of a millimeter, but some of them can be as large as 10 centimeters or even more. So you certainly can hold some of them in hands, yes.
Okay, I'm just trying to picture it. So phytoplankton are the tiny plants in the ocean that create the majority of oxygen in the air. How do they do that? And the key question here is, why is there a net gain of oxygen to the atmosphere?
Phytoplankton are not much more different in that aspect compared to all other plants. This is one of the generic features of most of the plants, that they consume CO2 and turn it by the process known as photosynthesis into a stock of the nutrients, a kind of sugar, which they use for their growth, and oxygen, free oxygen, as essentially byproduct.
How do scientists know that ocean temperature is the key determinant driving net production of oxygen by plankton?
There have been a few studies in about 10, 15 years ago, so several studies actually, and people just measured actually how the rate of oxygen production depends on their water temperature. And their key point here, important for the understanding, is that plants, all plants, and phytoplankton as well, do not only produce oxygen. They produce oxygen in the daytime because sunlight is an essential component of that. But they also consume oxygen during the night, because as well as all living creatures, they need oxygen to essentially to breathe, so for their metabolism. And the point is that their rate of consumption, oxygen consumption, and the rate of oxygen production, they depend differently on the temperature. So the net oxygen production, which is obviously the difference between production and consumption, it appears to decrease with the increase in temperature. That was something that was observed in the ocean.
And yet I was surprised and a little confused to read in your paper that scientists are not really sure whether oxygen production from plankton will increase or decrease as the seas warm. We don't really know that yet?
Well, we try to be careful with that, because I said there was several studies about that, which means that, in fact, only a handful of phytoplankton species was checked, right? But any plankton community consists of hundreds and hundreds of different species. And currently, at our current state of knowledge, we cannot rule out that there are species that respond differently to the increase in water temperature. So that's we just try to keep all possibilities open.
Well, fair enough. How did you deal with that uncertainty in trying to predict the impact of warming on plankton?
We considered two different scenarios, that is, two opposite scenarios. When one of them is when the net oxygen production actually decreases with the water temperature, as was observed in the ocean, at least for some species. And the second opposite, when the oxygen production actually increases with the temperature. And quite surprisingly, we observed that in both cases, even in the second case, which seems to be a good option, in both cases, there sufficiently large change in the rate of the oxygen production results in a disaster.
So any study needs a starting point, and I presume that would be our current state. And you say that maybe we're in a safe state now, or maybe it's not stable, but it's surrounded by a stable limit cycle. Could you tell us, what is a stable limit cycle?
A stable limit cycle is it's essentially a mathematical terminology. originated in the area of mathematics known as dynamical systems or dynamical systems theory. And it's essentially a periodic solution. And usually people talk about a stable limit cycle, which means that wherever system is at a current moment or at the initial moment, it will be eventually attracted by this cycle, so it will start oscillating, somehow oscillating according to this periodical solution, that is limit cycle. Does it make it any clearer? Or
Yes, I think I understood that. Now, no matter which model or path you worked with, as you said, it seemed to eventually lead to disaster with more warming. What is the worst-case scenario?
Well, both these cases, between ourselves and our research group, we call them Catastrophe 1 and Catastrophe 2. They are both catastrophes, so it's a difficult choice to choose between two bad things, really. So both of them result in oxygen depletion, which in real term would mean that their oxygen concentration in the atmosphere will drop at least a few times.
Do we know how fast the ocean is warming now? And from that, could we make any prediction about when we might cross that tipping point for the survival of plankton and maybe for ourselves?
Well, that depends on how things will be going, and that very much involves the political component of this global climate change. Because, there are different scenarios of further climate change, like best case and worst case. And in the worst case scenario, an increase in their global temperature, and which also means average increase in the water temperature in the oceans. So by worst case scenario, it will be about 4 degrees by the end of the century. And that would be dangerously close to the catastrophe predicted by our study.
You do say in the paper that one model suggests possible warning signs. Could you please tell us about that?
Yes, that's what we observed, is that it's not necessarily a considerable drop in their available oxygen in the atmosphere. It's more subtle, actually. Subtleness is that the oscillations, the temporal oscillations in the oxygen concentration that can be measured in the air and as well as in the oceans, the nature of these fluctuations, which are usually quite kind of random, quite chaotic, so they are going to become much more regular. So regularity is usually considered like a good thing compared to chaos. But in this case, regularity emerging in these fluctuations would likely mean that we are very close to the catastrophe.
Very interesting. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Sergei Petrovsky from the University of Leicester, UK. We're talking about the awful possibility that global warming could endanger the world's oxygen supply by killing off plankton in hotter seas. Sergei, doubt is built into the scientific process, and of course, we all want to reject such a big threat to life as being impossible. What sort of comments did you get back from the peer review process?
Well, in fact, it was one of the most positive reviews on my papers, definitely for the last several years. There were two reviewers, and both of them admitted that it's definitely very interesting and potentially very important study. And in fact, there was not a lot of comments. In fact, comments were only actually supposed to increase the clarity because their language was not good enough at some parts or some small inconsistencies. So it was purely technical, in fact.
Okay. You did factor in the animal type of plankton, the zooplankton, in your study, even though they don't produce oxygen. Why did you include them?
Sure, yes, but zooplankton does not produce oxygen, but they consume it. And any sensible model should account for a balance. So if there are species or components of the model that produce oxygen, then there may be also components that consume oxygen. I mean, we considered certain hierarchy of models. We actually started with a simple model which does not contain zooplankton. It's only phytoplankton and oxygen. And the simplest catastrophe, catastrophe one, which still result in a complete oxygen depletion, happens there. So that would correspond to their decrease in oxygen net production with the water temperature. But the second type of catastrophe, when their oxygen depletion follows as a result of the increase, surprisingly, of the increase in the oxygen net production, that only can be seen when we include additional feedbacks, additional oxygen consumption by zooplankton.
Another predicted change in the seas as they warm is more ocean stratification. If the oceans become more layered, then, as we know, essential nutrients upwelling to the plankton near the surface may not happen. Did you add this possibility to your model?
No, not yet. Not yet. And this is something which is definitely on our list of things to do. I mean, it should be made very clear that any model is essentially idealization, of course. And although we are certain, we feel confident that the main feedbacks have been included into the model, but of course there are many other factors that have not been included yet. And these details of, or some more details of oceanographic or ocean structure, like stratification, upwellings, and other things, they will need to be included, of course, which means that there is still a hope that this catastrophe is not as real as it seems now, hopefully.
It doesn't seem like a strong hope, but all right. Sergei Petrovsky, is there any way to test this theory other than living it out over history?
Oh, yes. There is at least a couple of things we are trying to arrange now by starting collaboration with other people. So first thing to do, or one way to check these predictions, would be to simply to check what may happen in a laboratory, in fact. So one can think about a relatively simple experiment, placing some phytoplankton into a controlled laboratory environment and changing temperature, checking the oxygen production, changing light intensity, all these things. So that should be doable. So we are currently trying to find a group of relevant group of biologists who could be able and willing to do that. And the second way is to look not into the future but into the past, because, of course, there is a very long history, a geological history of their living Earth, so to say. And geological history does show that there were a few catastrophes in the past that resulted in mass mortality of animals and plants. But, of course, for the moment it remains unclear whether the mechanism of those catastrophes was like we predicted or it was something completely different. So these are two things to move this research forward that we're currently thinking about.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that because I know the oceans have been very warm before. They even found crocodiles on Ellesmere Island in the Arctic Ocean in Canada. And just the fact that we still have plankton says that they haven't experienced any massive die-off. Wouldn't that be correct?
Well, not quite, because as I said, there were at least three or four, possibly five disastrous events in the geological history, so like long history really, like 10 million years ago. So, this mass mortality did not mean, of course, that everybody was killed. If everybody would have been killed, then there was no story to continue, really. So some relatively small group of animals and plants obviously survived after each of these catastrophes, and that was a driver for their new age in their biological evolution.
Well, ocean life is so large and complex, I'm not going to advise listeners to stock up on oxygen just yet, but that is not the purpose of your paper anyway. Sergei, what drove you to wonder about life limits in a warming ocean? And why do you suppose this really important and maybe obvious question hasn't been well studied before now?
Well, in my personal, so first part of your question, in my personal perspective, I guess it was kind of a natural stage because I used to be a senior scientist in their main Russian oceanography institute, which is called Shershov Oceanography Institute. And I worked there for 15 years and was heavily involved in plankton modeling. So at that time I was more interested in other things like factors controlling their spatial distribution and these sort of things. So to include oxygen into the models was, to some extent, was sort of a natural development of my interests. About the second part, I'm not really sure. I mean, I was reading a lot of papers over the last couple of years about that. And surprisingly, but it seems like most of the people just stuck on their global cycle of CO2. And then O2 is assumed to be sort of following that carbon dioxide cycle. So for that excessive interest to carbon dioxide cycle is, of course, understandable because CO2 is regarded as the main agent behind the global warming. Well, I suppose it has just been overlooked, maybe.
Well, important things do get overlooked, and sometimes the most obvious questions get asked last, has been my experience. Is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
Don't lose your hope. This catastrophe, I mean, we clearly see it in our models, but models are still models. Yeah? So it's very large and long work ahead to check their reality of those catastrophes and to check their actual dangerous threshold in their temperature increase. For the moment, it's very roughly assessed like 6 degrees, but it can be more than that, and unfortunately, it can be less than that, but it's still in the future. So, by saying don't lose your hope, I am quite serious because after my paper was published about 1 month ago, I received a lot of mail, in fact, and some people seem to be really scared. And of course, it was not my point to scare people. You know? So my point was to warn people that there may be more danger in this global climate change. So may some bad things may have been overlooked, but there is no reason to panic, not yet anyway.
Thank you for saying that and for doing this research. We've been talking with Sergei Petrovsky. He co-authored the paper Mathematical Modeling of Plankton Oxygen Dynamics Under the Climate Change, as published in the Bulletin of Mathematical Biology in November of 2015. The title may sound a bit boring, and there is a lot of math in the paper, but as you've just heard, the subject is critical if we want to avoid disturbing the ecosystem that enables us all to breathe. Find links to this paper and articles about it in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.info. Sergei, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure, Alex. My pleasure.
If I take only one thing away from this interview with Sergei Petrovsky, it is that reality is littered with traps. In hindsight, we can all see that a semi-intelligent species, discovering mechanical power from stored carbon riches, may well self-exterminate with them due to the carbon climate trap. That's why we have to be so cautious. But consider this. If Petrovsky is right, we may advance into the future fooled by the response of plankton. As the world warms, plankton could appear to thrive, providing lots of oxygen and sequestering ever more carbon dioxide. We all cheer. Apologists tell us our worries were overblown. But then, a limit beyond sustainable cycles is reached, and plankton worldwide could experience a mass die-off. That's another trap. It looks good until, as Petrovsky and his colleagues call it, catastrophe 2 occurs. Petrovsky tells us he was a senior scientist at the top Russian Oceanographic Institute. He specializes in plankton models. Maybe the model is wrong. Maybe our civilization is wrong. I hope the funding and the drive arrive soon to test out this plankton nightmare, rather than waiting to find out the hard way. Hey, what's this sticker on the gas pump? Me? You mean me? Cigarettes kill millions, and we warn users right on the pack. Burning gasoline kills the future. In Canada, Robert Shirky left his law practice to put us right into the climate changer driver's seat. Robert, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me on the program, Alex.
Okay, what do these climate labels on gas pumps look like?
Well, they are evocative of the tobacco warning labels. So often right now when you go gas up, there will be a 3-inch by 3-inch square on your gas pump that has an advertisement, maybe for a points program or come in and get your coffee. We're thinking on that space instead, why not have a climate change, call it a warning label, information label, or risk disclosure label, where the top half of it has an image that communicates an impact of climate change, and the lower half has some text. So some example text might read, you know, caution, use of this fuel product contributes to climate change, which may cause blank. And perhaps you want to highlight ocean acidification or extreme weather or what have you. And then, of course, there'd be a little link to a website on it where that will be a resource for all the different things that an individual can do to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions footprint.
Is this happening anywhere in the world?
It is. It's actually exciting. I've been advocating for it across Canada at the local level, so asking cities and towns to pass this into law required of gasoline retailers. Across Canada, we've had councils from coast to coast endorse the concept and call on other orders of government to implement it. And that, of course, gives us great leverage in our conversation with the province and the federal government. But it was in late 2015 that the city of North Vancouver in British Columbia became the first municipality in the world to actually pass it into law. Shortly after that, two more communities came on board on the West Coast, and more we expect in 2016. And these were global firsts. It was in all sorts of media around the world, and we got lots of interest from around the world. And so our game plan is we actually have volunteers across the country that are harvesting email addresses of politicians from all around the world from government websites. And in the next few weeks, we're going to send this concept and say, hey, here's this idea. It's low cost. Here's why we think it's compelling. And it's happening here in Canada. You should pursue this in your jurisdiction.
Do you have any interest in the United States?
We've been working with a few groups in San Francisco, Berkeley, Santa Monica, and Seattle. And there's a few members of different environmental groups there that through our guidance have been advocating for it. And they've been able to have some success, but there's a bit of a delay because there's a case on cell phone labels that's working its way through the courts, and counselors in those communities want to see the outcome of that case before passing this thing into law. So I think you'll see more action in the United States probably in the summertime after some legal questions are then resolved.
You know, I don't think about it. I drive my car up to the pump. I grab it and fill it up. Are you trying to make me feel guilty, or what's the idea here?
Yeah, well, that's not it. It's a simple intervention. All it really does is it communicates hidden costs or externalities to end users. Much in the same way, actually, I mean, you could say that pricing mechanisms, you know, like a carbon tax or a cap and trade regime, seek to capture and convey those harms, you know, via that quantitative approach to the end user. What this does is it uses a qualitative approach, so image and text, to capture and communicate these hidden costs of fossil fuels to the end user. And the idea is if you can disclose risk further downstream, that's what actually drives change upstream. So on the demand side of the equation, we have a habitual automatic behavior that's just part of the everyday fabric of living, and it's been normalized for a couple of generations. We don't even think twice about it. And if that's what you have, if that's the situation downstream, it's sort of the perfect downstream environment to almost perpetuate the status quo. And we tend to distance ourselves from the problem, so we'll point upstream, we'll say, well, it's a problem of pipelines and oil sands and offshore drilling and shipping and so on. And I think you will see some wins in that approach. But if at the end of the day, if we're not addressing the demand side of the equation, if we're not causing broader dissatisfaction with that status quo solution, it's going to be really hard to sort of transition away from fossil fuels. So all this does is it makes us feel more connected to the problem, makes it more tangible, more real, takes that faraway consequence, brings it into the here and now. And in doing so, it makes us less satisfied with the status quo. It makes us say, well, but what am I supposed to do? What are my options? And if you get, you know, if I start to say that, if you do, if our neighbors do, if an entire community does, if an entire marketplace does, you're creating this ideal social environment for reform. So all of a sudden, a politician then will have greater political capital to be able to implement climate-friendly initiatives, you know, A, B, and C. And you'll see as well, I think, auto manufacturers be incentivized to deliver alternate solutions to meet this shifted demand. So it's a simple, low-cost intervention to make the problem more real. And I think that's a necessary first step to then more meaningful reforms.
How does the amount of emissions that actually come from us, the consumers, relate to things like the tar sands and the pipeline projects?
Well, interestingly, it's actually the vast majority of emissions that come from end use. So it depends on how carbon intense your fuel choice is. So say if you get something from the oil sands, it's going to be about 30% of emissions come from extraction, processing, and moving the product. If it's a light crude, then you're looking at something like 20% of emissions might come from upstream sources. But really, at the end of the day, it's not, when it comes to greenhouse gas emissions, it's not, you know, taking the stuff out of the earth. It's not then refining it or shipping it to a point of consumption. It's when you and I combust the product, when we burn it in our vehicles, that's actually where the vast majority of emissions come from. And separate and apart from that, I mean, if we do transition away from the internal combustion engine, then that drives so much change upstream, because I like to think, and a lot of economists would agree with this, that the value of a commodity is derived from its uses. So it's critical to ask that question, well, how do we use the product? It's critical to look at uses, because if you address that aspect, then you drive all sorts of change upstream.
Robert Cherkey, I have to ask on a personal level, how could you give up a career in law to become a climate activist? That's never going to pay very well. Take it from me.
Well, I realized it doesn't pay very well at all. I think I understood the urgency and the gravity of the problem. And I wasn't all that happy practicing law. It wasn't as fulfilling as, you know, I might have hoped it to have been. And I was concerned about this problem. And it was actually my grandfather who, before he passed away, his last words to me were to do what you love. And I recall being at his funeral in Saskatchewan and standing over top of his grave and my father, you know, beside him who had passed away a few years prior. And next to that was this empty patch of green grass. And there I was staring down at that, you know, with those words echoing through my head, do what you love. And I realized that, hey, you know, I'm kind of staring down mortality. We all are. And I started to ask myself some of the bigger questions and, you know, what do I do with the time left? So I've always had a few interesting ideas for campaigns. This was one. I just eventually sort of plucked it off the back burner and transitioned to this work. And while I'm certainly, you know, racking up debt, I can't say it is more meaningful, and we're optimistic, actually. It's tough fundraising in Canada if you lack charitable status, and given the nature of my political advocacy, I can't get charitable status. But our hope is that if we get lucky, if we get one philanthropist that says, hey, you know what, you guys are creating Global First, you've got a game plan to get this all around the world, I want to support this, I value impact, say, more than I do a tax receipt, I think that 2016 might be the year we get a bit of a break. And hopefully then I'll slowly work my way back out of debt. In the meantime, the party's on Visa and MasterCard.
Oh, Robert, we do need more like you. Now tell us how people can find out more and get this gas pump label into our own community.
Well, I'd encourage everyone listening to visit ourhorizon.org. That's www.our, like yours and mine, horizon.org. And from there, there's all sorts of resources. There's a TEDx talk, there's longer lectures, there's pre-written emails that you can send to your counselors. Easy thing to do is just take a moment to go there, learn about it, and then write your representatives. The other thing, too, if you are able to support the campaign financially, we've got a crowdfund where even a dollar or two or $5 a month, you know, over a lot of people actually does go a long way. And with that, I can have, I'm looking to hopefully hire my first staff person to do a lot of the work. So, yeah, so two ways to help: advocate for it, one, and if you're able to contribute. And if by chance, if there is a billionaire listening to this broadcast, you know, call me. It would be amazing to have some support. So thank you.
I wonder if we do have any billionaire listeners. We might. Okay, folks, try this out. Ourhorizon.org. You can do it. Get your local government to require climate warning labels on gas pumps. I'm Alex Smith reporting. Get all our past programs as free MP3 files at ecoshock.org. Check out my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. And tell your friends about the Radio EcoShock page on SoundCloud. I'm Alex. Thank you for listening and caring about your world.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
In Oakland, I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. Activists in the occupied West Bank city of Hebron have been staging a daily sit-in protest at an Israeli military checkpoint installed at the entrance to Shahada Street in the Old City, which leads to the area occupied and taken over by Israeli settlers. The protest began on January 7th when local activists say a woman, Wafa Sharabati, was arrested at the checkpoint and harassed by Israeli soldiers. Palestinians have been harassed, threatened, violently attacked, and killed across the Old City by Israeli soldiers and settlers in and around Hebron's Tel Rumeida neighborhood in heightened attacks since the beginning of October 2015. Israeli forces have killed more than 150 Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip since October. According to the local organization Youth Against Settlements, on November 1st, the Israeli military, quote, declared Shahada Street and much of the Tel Rumeida neighborhood in Hebron to be a closed military zone, meaning that only registered residents of the neighborhoods who have been assigned numbers may enter. The residents must be registered with numbers assigned to them and may not have visitors to their houses. Youth Against Settlements adds that on January 2nd, the Israeli military, quote, renewed the closed military zone order through January 31st and released a new map showing the original closed military zone of Shahada Street and much of the Tel Rumeida neighborhood, with an extension reaching out just far enough to include the house of Youth Against Settlements coordinator Issa Amro, which also serves as the Youth Against Settlements Center. Joining us to talk about the sit-in protest and the current situation in Hebron is Issa Amro. Issa, thank you so much for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you very much.
So can you begin by telling us about this sit-in protest? This is day 14 of this direct action. What are you calling for and what are your demands?
The Israeli occupation forces are making our life impossible. We were living in basic life inside Shahada Street neighborhood and Tel Rumeida neighborhood. In spite of the presence of the checkpoints, the Israeli military, the soldiers, the armed Israeli settlers in the two neighborhoods, the Israeli occupation forces declared the area as a closed military zone, which means that as Palestinians, we are not allowed to have guests, we are not allowed to have journalists in our houses, our relatives, you know, they can't visit us in our homes. We don't feel safe inside this closed military zone. On the other hand, the Israeli settlers who are living in the same area, they are the minority. They have visitors, they have free access to all the area. They are allowed to drive their own cars, but we are not allowed. They are allowed to have their own ambulances. Palestinians are not allowed. We don't have any protection from the Israeli military or Israeli police when the settlers attack us. In the contrary, army is making the life of the Palestinian harder and harder. We decided to start a sit-in tent to put pressure on the Israeli government to stop working in the closed military zone order on our area. and we say that we refuse it. It's affecting our life. It's affecting our freedom of movement, and it's affecting our basic rights as human beings living in that area. This is the first demand. The second demand, to stop working on numbering the people at the checkpoints. We as Palestinians, we refuse to be numbers. We want to be as human being treated all over the world, not numbers on lists, as the Israeli army is doing at the checkpoints. They just, you know, ignore our names. They ignore our characters. They just give a number for each person in the family or in living in the neighborhoods, the two neighborhoods. The third demand, which is very important, to reopen Youth Against Settlement Human Rights Defender Center, which was closed because of the closed military zone order, where Palestinians are not allowed to come to have non-violence training, where journalists, locals, and international journalists don't have any meeting point with the Palestinian human rights defenders or with the families, where Israeli activists can't come and, you know, try to struggle the closure and the occupation. The fourth demand, we are asking to reopen Shuhada Street and reopen all the shops, all the closed Palestinian apartments, which was closed first on 1994 after the Ibrahimi Mosque massacre. And we are preparing now the seventh annual campaign to reopen Shuhada Street, which will be, you know, between the 18th of February till the 28th of February next month. It's all over the world. We ask our friends, our supporters, people who cares about human rights to organize something between that date, because it's the anniversary of the Ibrahimi Mosque massacre, where Palestinians were killed inside the Ibrahimi Mosque, and the Israeli army closed many streets and many shops and many markets. And the fifth demand is to end the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian land and give the Palestinians their own freedom and their own self-determination, and you know to stop settler violence and Israeli occupation in the Palestinian land.
Issa Amro, can you describe what the closed military zone actually looks like? How many soldiers are roaming the old city? What the checkpoint situation is? What does it look like when the army imposes these closed military zone policies on your neighborhood?
Closed military zone means no life, no safety, no human rights, nothing. Why? It's only soldiers who are dealing with the Palestinians without any rights. You need to pass the checkpoint to get into your house. If you want to buy candy or to buy biscuits or to buy anything from the shop, you need to pass the checkpoint and come back to the checkpoint, where you are not allowed to have visitors. You are not allowed to have friends coming in with you to your house, to your street, to your neighborhood, where, you know, you are not a character. You are just a number inside the military zone. You don't have any access for ambulances, because the ambulance needs previous coordination between Red Cross and the Israeli army, which means that you skip all the emergency cases. You can't live a normal life inside your house. If you need an electrician, if you need a plumber, if you need someone to fix your TV, your satellite, they can't come. They are not allowed. If you need anything, any maintenance in your house, you can't do it. You need to wait. You don't know till when. It's closed military zone now. It's since 3 months, and they are just renewing it by time. You are not safe in your house. You feel that you are completely isolated from other Palestinian neighborhoods, from your city, from other cities, from other villages. You feel that you are in jail without food and without safety. This is the closed military zone.
Can you talk a little bit more about Israel's restrictions on access or denial of access by medical relief agencies such as ambulances, the Palestinian Red Crescent paramedic teams, medical workers, when Palestinian residents of the Old City are wounded, shot, or in need of immediate medical attention? Talk a little bit more about how this closed military zone policy affects people's rights to get medical attention.
If you have any emergency case in your house in Tel Rumeida and Shuhada Street, you need to call the Palestinian Red Crescent to send you the ambulance. And the Palestinian Red Crescent station is only 3 minutes far from the two neighborhoods, but it needs a lot of work between the Palestinian Red Crescent and Red Cross and the Israeli civil administration, the Israeli army, to coordinate for the ambulance to get in, which means that you skip all the emergency cases. So if you have an emergency cases, the golden minutes are lost. So the ambulance can't reach in 10 minutes to your house. The last time a family called for ambulance, the ambulance reached the neighborhood after 45 minutes, which means that they were lucky even after 45 minutes. Many times we ask for ambulances, the ambulance was not allowed to come in and was denied because of settler violence and the Israeli soldier aggression in that area. So you skip all the emergency cases. We don't have any medical clinics inside that area, so we are just suffering a lot from the shortage of, you know, access to the clinics and to the ambulances and to the hospitals.
We're speaking with Issa Amro. He is the coordinator of Youth Against Settlements inside the Old City of Hebron in the occupied West Bank. Issa, Hebron, and especially the neighborhood in which you live, has been a flashpoint of violence by the Israeli military and Israeli settlers for decades, but especially in the last 3 months. Can you talk about daily life in the Old City right now and what kind of regular harassment and violence Palestinians face?
The regular harassment and violence we are facing, first of all, the presence of the checkpoints. It's a big harassment for the Palestinians to pass a checkpoint whenever they leave their home. So the checkpoint is blocking the people from their homes and the schools, the universities, the work, the shops, the market. It's not, you know, the checkpoint, it's not between two countries or two villages or two cities. It's between your house and the shop. It's your house and your school, your house and your university, your house and your brother. So to pass a checkpoint and to hear a lot of, you know, orders from the Israeli soldiers who are shouting, yelling, and you are not allowed to have any kind of metal on your body, to take off your clothes, to raise your clothes to. It's really hard for a human being to bear that behavior from the Israeli soldiers, who are very fanatic and they like humiliating you at 20 checkpoints in a small area. This is one hand. On the other hand, the soldiers, they do a lot of house search during the night, house raid. They come in the middle of the night. It's very cold now in Palestine. So the soldiers come, they put you in one room. Sometimes they force you, all the family, I mean, force you to leave your house outside when it's raining and cold, and stay and wait till they search the house. It's not searching the house. It's about upside down the house and the furniture and everything in the house. So you come back to your house, you find mess, big mess inside your house. Soldiers, you know, they like to do that, and they just leave in 1 hour, 2 hours, and you spend 2-3 days to reorganize the stuff. They just throw it here or there. On the other hand, settlers are armed. They are pointing their guns at us from time to time. They just, you know, intimidate us as Palestinians living in that area. And they say all the time they are waiting any opportunity to kill us, which makes us all feel not safe, not secure in our houses, in our homes. Why? Because as Palestinians, we are under the Israeli military law, which means that we are guilty till we prove the opposite. And the settlers are living just next door are under the Israeli civilian law. Two different laws are implemented in the same area, and settlers, they have, you know, a privilege to be under the civilian law, and they, whatever they say to the army, to the police, to the Israeli police, they are saying the ultimate truth, and we need as Palestinians to prove the opposite, that they lie about the false complaint they filed against us, and it's happening a lot. And me, many, many times I was arrested by false complaints from the Israeli settlers and false complaints from the Israeli soldiers. What more is very important, throwing stones to our houses from the Israeli settlers, throwing Molotov cocktails sometimes to our houses, and we can do nothing. The settler kids, they just cut the water pipes in front of the soldiers, so you don't have water for 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. Nowadays, because of the military zone, you the municipality can't come, and it needs a special coordination to come to fix the broken water pipes, which settlers just, you know, cut from time to time, throwing stones, saying a lot of bad words. Sometimes they block you from going out from your house. Sometimes you are not allowed to walk in the street. So it's a big intimidation, and many families just very afraid to stay there. And the main idea and the main strategy behind all this behavior, we call it quiet transfer policy for the Palestinians. So they are transferring the Palestinians from their homes, and they want to take it over in the future.
Finally, Issa, talk about how this current situation is affecting children in your neighborhood. Of course, against the backdrop of years and years of tight occupation and violence by Israeli settlers and soldiers, you're a leader in your community. What are young people saying to you about their daily lives right now? What are they struggling for?
I am doing my best since 10 years to convince the Palestinian youth to use nonviolence as the only method to end the occupation. But unfortunately, this violence from the Israeli occupation forces toward the Palestinian children and toward the Palestinian 18-year-olds is making them sometimes don't believe in nonviolence, and they are just making my work less successful. And I am struggling to convince them again about nonviolence in the time of the huge amount of violence coming toward the Israeli soldiers and the Israeli settlers. Many of the kids, many of the children, they are very hopeless, disappointed, angry, and just, you know, feel that they have no future in this country. And they just, you know, feel that it's really hard to stay and remain without reacting to the Israeli violence by violence.
And talk a little bit about how people can get in touch with Youth Against Settlements and the work that you're continuing to do in the Old City.
Unfortunately, our center was closed, which affected our output and affected our efficiency in recruiting more and more Palestinian youth to nonviolence, in increasing the awareness in the local community and in the international community. We are trying to have a new center now. We are using the city tent for meetings, for planning for the Open to the Street campaign, which is coming soon. And we are just, you know, trying to reach more people in the universities, in the schools. We use the social media a lot to recruit and to increase the awareness about what are we doing and what we want others to do.
That's the voice of Issa Amro. He is the coordinator of Youth Against Settlements. Issa, thank you so much for all the work that you do and for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Okay, thank you very much.
And that's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net, where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on iTunes, support the Electronic Intifada podcast by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dr. Robert Czar, President of Physicians for a National Health Program, who assesses the current debate between Democratic presidential candidates Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders over single-payer health care. Anti-pipeline activist Hattie Nessel, who explains why she and her neighbors embarked on a three-day winter walk in opposition to a proposed frack gas pipeline in western Massachusetts. And Michelle Higgins of the groups Faith for Justice and the Organization for Black Struggle, who talks about the nationwide protest actions that were organized during the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. holiday weekend. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Democracy is in full retreat in Tajikistan, the poorest nation in Central Asia, which borders Afghanistan, China, and Pakistan. President Emomali Rahmon, who took power in 1994, has banned the moderate opposition Islamic Renaissance Party of Tajikistan and labeled it a terrorist organization as activists have fled the country. Now the pro-Rahmon parliament has honored the president as leader of the nation, effectively giving him immunity for life from any future criminal prosecution. Economic sanctions on Russia have also crippled Tajikistan, which relies on remittances sent back by Tajiks working there. Now over 300,000 migrants have returned home with little prospect of finding a job. According to a new report by the International Crisis Group, Tajikistan is at risk of becoming a staging area for radical Islamists looking for a home base in Central Asia. The ruling elite in Dushanbe were shocked by the defection to ISIS of General Gumurod Kalimov, head of the Special Assignment Police Unit. Further, the 1997 peace agreement between President Rahmon and moderate Islamists has completely broken down. In the midst of the political crisis, a deputy defense minister affiliated with the opposition fled the country rather than face trumped-up charges against him of plotting a coup. Amidst the overheated anti-immigrant rhetoric from Republican presidential candidates Donald Trump and Ted Cruz, Latino voters in Iowa are mobilizing for the February 1st caucus. Unions and Hispanic groups are engaging with Democratic candidates and looking to build political power in the purple Midwestern state. Union meatpackers at JBS Swift & Company met recently in central Iowa to talk about the Democrats running for president and mobilizing 10,000 Latinos on caucus night. Christian Euclis of the League of Latin American Citizens in Iowa told the Guardian newspaper, "We have so much to lose if we don't participate. We have so much to lose if candidates like Trump think they can dehumanize and demoralize our community, all because they don't fear our voting power." Iowa's Latino population has grown rapidly as immigrants arrived to work in the state's meatpacking plants and established roots in cities like Des Moines. Latinos are now the largest ethnic minority in the Hawkeye State. Activist Maru Abarca, who is knocking on doors to boost Latino turnout for the February 1st Iowa caucuses, declared, "We are tired of sitting back and being underestimated." Minneapolis is home to a new innovative pilot project designed to break up the cycle of homelessness among young adults with children. Youth participants involved with the initiative, known as Heading Home Hennepin, have seen a 36% rise in individual income. According to the Christian Science Monitor, parents under the age of 25 with children are the most likely to enter a cycle of homelessness. Other adults often become homeless due to the loss of a job, but younger adults in their early 20s often lack life and job skills to support families. The Minneapolis Public Schools estimated 4,000 students became homeless in the last school year. Nationally, more than 2.5 million youths go homeless annually. Many homeless youth in Minneapolis find their way to a drop-in center at Youth Link. The agency hosts a hub of social services, offering assistance with basic needs like food and health care. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
One of the defining issues separating the two major candidates vying for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination is disagreement on the need to establish a single-payer health care system in the United States. While independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders advocates such a system, sometimes referred to as Medicare for All, his opponent, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, says the proposal would be too expensive for taxpayers and not politically viable. Clinton and her campaign have accused Senator Sanders of promoting a plan that would do away with the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, effectively end Medicare, Medicaid, the Children's Health Program, and other government health care benefits. In response, Sanders asserts his proposal would provide universal health care for the first time in U.S. history, repairing the major deficiencies in Obamacare that has left 29 million Americans without health insurance and many more underinsured. The U.S., Sanders repeatedly reminds his audiences, is the only industrial nation in the world today without a universal health care system. Your reporter spoke with Dr. Robert Czar, president of the group Physicians for a National Health Program and a board-certified pediatrician at Unity Healthcare in Washington, D.C. Here, Dr. Czar assesses the validity of Hillary Clinton's criticisms of Sanders' advocacy of a single-payer system and the relative strengths and weaknesses of President Obama's Affordable Care Act.
Single-payer national health insurance, as it's described in a physician's proposal that was published in JAMA back in 2003, and as is largely represented in two pieces of legislation, H.R. 676, which is Conyers' bill, as well as Sanders' Senate companion bill, which is 1782, would take a program called Medicare that's been around, established since 1965, and improve it and expand it. In fact, the title of H.R. 676, which is Conyers' single-payer bill, it's called Expanded and Improved Medicare for All. So to say that there'd be any dismantling is simply not true. It would actually be building on what we have currently in this country, which is single-payer for Americans over the age 65. I think it's more accurate to say that we would take funds to pay for the programs that the Hillary Clinton has listed, take that money and roll it into a Medicare fund. And by doing that, then you have enormous administrative savings. And it's through that administrative savings that you see at least $400 billion saved a year, which can then be a big part of to explain how we can provide every American finally with a national health insurance card, which means a very, very generous basket of benefits from birth to death. That's what really needs to be said to the American public. I wouldn't use the word dismantling. It's not quite capturing the essence of Medicare for All, which is taking a program that runs fairly efficiently. We're talking about an overhead of about, less than 3%, which is in huge contrast to private insurance companies, which runs in the double digits, often as high as 18%. So taking that efficiency of Medicare's administrative efficiency there and using it to provide care for everybody.
Dr. Robert Czar, Hillary Clinton basically places her bets on reforming and expanding the current Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, to get to a more inclusive system moving towards universal health care, whereas Bernie Sanders says we really have to bypass the current structure of the ACA. Is it possible to reform and expand the Affordable Care Act to move towards universal health care, or do we really have to move to an entirely different system, as Bernie Sanders claims?
Well, it's not really a matter of my opinion. It's a matter of science, and it's a matter of listening to data. So, I think at the end of the day, if someone says to you, we've got, more than two decades of really solid foundational health policy research that shows hands down that there is no other way we know of in the world to provide health care from the day you're born to the day you die, give you a very, very generous basket of benefits and do it in a very efficient and cost-effective manner, and that single payer, it would be false and misguiding if I said anything else. Physicians for a National Health Program is, as you know, a nonpartisan organization, and being a nonprofit, we don't endorse candidates. We're about telling the truth, and I think that's why so much of the world looks to us as an example of where facts really lie. So this really has very little to do with my opinion, and it has to do with facts. And the facts will never change. The facts are that we cannot continue to rely on a system that depends on a for-profit driven industry whose main motive is profit for their shareholders. You know, we need to move to a system that is efficient and encourages quality, is equitable, and provides for every American without bankrupting the country and individuals for the years to come. So, you know, that's simply the truth. Now, whether we choose to believe that or not, that's one thing. But, you know, we're really an organization who's tasked with, analyzing data to guide sound healthcare policy. Politics is a whole other discussion, of which I am not an expert. But I can tell you from a health policy perspective, there are a few people in this country who would disagree with the facts.
Dr. Robert Saar, as we close here, what is your hope for the debate over single payer in this 2016 presidential election campaign?
Physicians like myself and the public at large are thrilled that we're talking about this again. The majority of physicians support the creation of national health insurance. So the docs are on board. We've had survey after survey of the American public who support expanding and improving Medicare. So, you know, my hope is that, you know, this kind of issue be raised again and again during the next few months so that we have a chance to educate and I hope also to activate, our population in this country to do something about this, because there is a solution to our nightmare, and it's called single-payer national health insurance.
That was Dr. Robert Saar, president of the group Physicians for a National Health Program. Learn more about the debate between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders on the merits and cost of a single-payer healthcare system by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. When it comes to opposition to proposed frack gas pipelines across the country, one of the best organized grassroots movements is based in the hill towns of rural Northwest Massachusetts. For over a year, property owners, local officials, the president of the state senate, and major environmental groups have all intervened in the permitting process for a pipeline with FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Opponents maintain that the Tennessee Pipeline Company's Northeast Energy Direct Pipeline isn't needed or wanted to bring frack gas from Pennsylvania through New York, Massachusetts, and New Hampshire, which they say will be exported to eastern Canada. In November, Kinder Morgan, Tennessee Pipeline's parent company, filed information with FERC indicating the company may want to use a substantial percentage of the gas to feed a massive gas-powered electric power plant that could be built somewhere along the proposed pipeline route. More than 1,700 interveners have filed their opposition to the pipeline with FERC, which may be the largest number for any proposed pipeline. Hattie Nessel, who's 77 years old and a pipeline opponent, was struck with the idea of organizing a three-day walk over the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday weekend from the site of a proposed gas compressor station in the town of Northfield to the site of a planned pipe storage facility 34 miles away in Plainfield. In less than a month, with no formal meetings or budget, and despite naysayers who doubted anyone would march for 3 days in mid-January's frigid temperatures, more than 100 people marched at least part of each day, from babies in strollers to octogenarians. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus participated in the walk to learn firsthand from the mostly local residents about their concerns and spoke with Hattie Nessel at the end of the second day of the walk. Here Nessel explains why she took on the project and what defeating the pipeline will mean for residents and the environment of the area she calls home.
If you really read and study Martin Luther King's life and his thinking and his commitments, he didn't always do what was popular. He didn't always do what people thought he should do. He did what was some inner light guided him to do. He followed his inner light. And I just put this out to people because my inner light said we should take this 3-day walk to commemorate him and to fight the pipeline and put the word out there about the pipeline. Hundreds of people have walked. They've supported the walk. They've cooked for the walk. They're putting us up at night. Every need is met. It's just a beautiful explosion of people coming together, young children, young mothers, older people, whatever, to do this work to stop the pipeline. And I'm sure that Martin Luther King's vision would have included the destruction of the earth as a real human rights violation and a lack of democracy. And those were things that really were important to him.
The Kinder Morgan pipeline, just trace the path from where it enters Massachusetts and where it leaves and, you know, what people are doing to oppose it and why.
Yeah, first of all, it comes up from the fracked fields of Pennsylvania, the Marcellus Shale, and the fracking process is very devastating to people. So that's part of the problem. And it's devastating to the workers. They're inhaling all kinds of carcinogens and methane that's very bad for the environment. Wells have been destroyed. People are getting really sick around in Pennsylvania, which is where I'm originally from. And then it goes up through New York by pipe, and they want to come through Massachusetts with a pipe load of this fracked gas. So on many different levels, we don't want this gas. We have all kinds of laws and constitutional amendments that say that protected land, conserved land should be protected. It should not be destroyed. And this company is just in it for the profit. We would have to pay for it. We'd have to pay for the litigation, whatever was going on. Our housing values would be destroyed. But really the worst thing is species habitats would be destroyed. Our waterways would be destroyed. Our forests would be cut down. We would no longer be the same area, a rural, beautiful, pristine area that we were if the pipeline were to come through.
So when you were walking the path of the pipeline, goes right over or right through a lot of land that's in conservation, and that's illegal, right?
Something like 1,000 parcels would be impacted. So we really want to stop the pipeline to avoid that kind of destruction. We value our lands. We value our quiet rural life. People are really very fraught over the idea that somebody could have an easement through their property very close to their house or their fields, their organic farms, their cow pastures, whatever. We also have a lot of legislators that are really with us. They live in these rural areas, several of them, and they listen to their constituents' concerns, and they are in there trying to stop it also. It's a very fraught process for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. They have every right to just go right ahead and permit this application without a lot of information and a lot of specific information. They have a lot of outdated information. They submitted it with 30-year-old maps, which don't apply to our communities anymore. People are really upset about this. So there's a lot of activism in Massachusetts to stop this pipeline, and we might do it. We just might do it.
That was Hattie Nessel, organizer of the Martin Luther King Jr. Holiday Walk to Stop the NED Pipeline in western Massachusetts. For more information on the pipeline protest, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Over the past year and a half, tens of thousands of people from across the United States have participated in protests calling attention to and demanding action to stop unjustified police violence in communities of color. The Black Lives Matter movement was launched after the police killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and Eric Garner in New York City during the summer of 2014. The movement's relevancy is continually demonstrated with frequent incidents of police misconduct now being captured on video recordings. The October 2014 Chicago police shooting of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald exploded into a major scandal after it was revealed that video evidence, which clearly showed police use of unnecessary deadly force, was suppressed for over a year. The McDonald case has provoked calls for the resignation of Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel and other officials. The failure of a grand jury to indict the officers involved in the shooting death of 12-year-old Tamir Rice in Cleveland has triggered demands for a federal investigation into the young man's death. Rice was shot by a white police officer in November 2014, just 2 seconds after a squad car arrived at the scene, responding to a call that the boy was likely carrying a toy gun. Your reporter spoke with Michelle Higgins, director of the group Faith for Justice and an active member of the Organization for Black Struggle. Here she talks about the nationwide Reclaim MLK protest actions that were organized during the 2015 Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. holiday weekend. The actions were centered around the movement's three demands: divest from racist systems and invest in black communities, recapture community control, and establish alternative institutions.
The main idea, especially as we enter into Black Heritage Month from Dr. King's commemoration of his birthday, is this idea that the civil rights movement is somehow over, somehow that because we have achieved racism or discrimination as illegal broadly, federally, there's an assumption that discrimination no longer occurs. That Ella Baker herself, one of the greatest civil rights movement leaders, if not the mother of civil rights movement, Ella Baker said, once we get legislation passed, we're still not free yet. We're not free until we know that we have control over what happens in our communities. We're not free until institutions, until the government divests from building prisons and invests and building black futures. We're not free. And so the Reclaim MLK and the modern Black Lives Matter and Movement for Black Lives, those movements are actually a continuation of a civil rights struggle that never ended. The era of civil rights has not ended. In fact, Coretta Scott King herself said, generations, different generations, will struggle for freedom in their own way. And that's what the Black Lives Matter movement is, and that's what the broader network of movements for the dignity and value of all Black lives are striving towards. I mean, we face issues with specifically people of color who are transsexual, are abused and targeted, people of color who have committed past crimes find that there is no opportunity for rehabilitation, real rehabilitation in their communities. People of color who are innocent and yet are still convicted and imprisoned without regard to the fact that when you're poor, you don't have access to excellent care from the law, to good defense attorneys. There's no consideration in our system that freedom, this actual releasing of enslaved people, making lynching illegal, all that did was change a law. We are now after making the laws effective by forcing people to admit that their hearts are still hard. And that is why we resist. We have to resist the efforts to keep peace, which is just telling us to be quiet, in order to make transformative change, which is demanding that we raise our voices, share our stories, and be accepted as citizens, as fellow citizens in this country.
Beautifully said. Thank you, Michelle. For our listeners who may not have heard a lot of the details about these protest actions, vigils, civil disobedience that took place around the country over this King holiday weekend, describe some of the actions for us.
Our partners in Chicago hosted a rally and a march specifically focusing on police brutality and crime. So corruption, punitive killings, especially killing of black people by law enforcement, recent cover-ups going on in Chicago were brought to light. The broad appeal that I have sensed from these actions is to shine a light on something that everybody hoped would remain covered up, to shine a light on issues and corruption that people are begging citizens to leave invisible. We have to make it visible. And our commitment really is not to destroy a system that might have some good. We're not saying no one should ever be punished. Our commitment is to destroy the evils, to take down and restructure a system that has to be renewed if it's going to work. And we really can't develop a healthy trust in law enforcement unless and until law enforcement is ready to admit that they have to be held accountable. So it's been a very striking, a very important move in our partners around the country to see them say, we're going to continue this rallying cry, and we're going to continue to focus boldly on the brutality, corruption, and state-sanctioned killings that are going on in our cities around the country. And that was, in Chicago, a really excellent focus for right now. In St. Louis, our struggle has been not only with police brutality and corruption, but with drawing moderate, perhaps hesitant people from the sidelines into the movement. People who would click like on Facebook, who haven't stepped out of their houses to raise their voices in unity with people in this movement, with folks who are in the struggle. People who would say, I'm going to read this book, but I'm not quite ready to march hand in hand in certain sections of my city that I deem quote unquote dangerous. We decided to do a movement that incorporated faith communities, activists, and protesters from all walks of life. We intentionally set out in the city of St. Louis to connect people who normally would not look each other in the eye and call one another friends. So our event was focused on reclaiming MLK by taking our neighborhoods and really challenging each other to behave more like family.
That was Michelle Higgins, director of the group Faith for Justice and an active member of the Organization for Black Struggle. Learn more about the groups active in the Black Lives Matter movement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
MLK, enemy of the state. The name Martin Luther King Jr. has become an American talisman. Politicians who have spent their entire careers ignoring or attacking the lives, rights, or interests of African Americans erupt in praise of King, some even using choice quotes to support their positions as if King would have supported any of them. The truth is Martin Luther King was targeted by the U.S. government, by high officials, and by federal police at the FBI. One of the highest officials in J. Edgar Hoover's FBI called King, quote, the most dangerous Negro leader in the country, unquote. As the nation celebrates King, let us not forget the role of the U.S. government in his destruction. Specifically, let us remember the now-forgotten Church Committee hearings of winter 1975, when, in open committee, senators and congressional staff members discussed FBI attempts to replace Dr. King, as shown by the following discussion between staff member Mike Epstein and Senator the late Walter Mondale of Minnesota. Mr. Epstein, I might add, Mr. Chairman, I do not have the document in front of me, but the document that recommended the discrediting of Dr. King and the appointing of a new leader, which was in January of 1964, which was the recommendation from Mr. Sullivan. And he was soliciting in that memorandum the director's authorization to pursue that possibility further, a recommendation that approval be given for him to explore this whole matter in a greater detail as set forth above. And underneath it is, quote, okay, H, unquote. And then there is the note from the director which says, I am glad to see that light has finally, though dismally delayed, come to the Domestic Intelligence Division. I struggled for months to get over the fact that the communists were taking over the racial movement, but our experts here couldn't or wouldn't see it, H. Senator Mondale, that was the memo in which it was proposed that King be destroyed and that the FBI ought to sponsor his replacement by another person not in the civil rights movement. Mr. Epstein, that is correct. Senator Mondale, and Hoover personally appreciated that suggestion. Is that correct? Mr. Epstein, he okayed it. That's from the U.S. Senate hearings into government operations, popularly known as the Church Committee hearings, after Senator Frank Church, the committee's chairman from Idaho, November 19, 1975, Volume 6, page 59. Think about that the next time you hear some politician quote Dr. King or cry crocodile tears over his martyrdom. The U.S. government tried to destroy him and then replace him. Yeah, happy King Day. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Of human communal time, People built cities adjacent to rivers, for water, fresh water, was the source of life. Cairo, and before it grew into Cairo, Fustat, relied on the Nile. London, and before that, the Roman colonial city of Londonium, was built upon the banks of the Thames. Paris, originally known as Par Isis, or the House of Isis, grew from the flow of the Seine. Rome rose to become an empire along the banks of the river Tiber. Cities feed upon and grow from the waters beside them. Flint, Michigan is named after the Flint River for the hard, dark flint stones that formed its riverbed. For decades, General Motors drew from it and then poured into it its chemical wastes and effluvium until it became the corrosive, toxic brew that it is now. Indeed, after the waters became so acidic that it damaged automobile parts, GM bailed out, closing their operations there. These are the waters that Michigan officials, under so-called emergency management powers, to save money, routed into Flint homes and bodies. Waters that damaged and dissolved metals was found fine enough to feed the population of human beings in a modern American city. Thousands, tens of thousands of people poisoned for profit. Why is that not a crime? Why was it not a crime to poison a river in the first place? For the same reason that it is not a crime today to order the poisoning of thousands of people for corporate and state profit. Thousands of people, many of them children, poisoned in their brains, their livers, their kidneys, their lungs, their bones, for life in many cases. And even the talking heads on corporate media outlets are speaking of lawsuits and civil damages. More money that can't cure. When is a crime not a crime? When corporations do it. When governments do it. The U.S. government, through the military, committed genocide in Iraq, destroying one of the oldest civilizations on Earth based on lies, ignorance, and arrogance. It tortured Iraqis in American-run hellholes and busted a few low-life guards. It opened up a torture chamber in Cuba and suspended the Constitution and called it justice. There's actually a joint called Camp Justice in Guantanamo Bay, I kid you not. In a capitalist society, only capital matters. It's all about the Benjamins, bucks over bodies, profit, period. In Michigan's prisons, there ain't a single prisoner who committed a more vicious crime than the governor of that state. Their crimes, no matter what, were retail. The government, for a few bucks, committed crimes against thousands, wholesale. But these are crimes of the powerful. They don't count. These are crimes of capitalism. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Did U.S. state and legal authorities deliberately frame Mumia Abu-Jamal for the murder of a white police officer in 1981? Is the state now trying to murder him through medical neglect of his hepatitis C condition? What threat does he pose to those authorities? Is the repression of Mumia symptomatic of a larger apparatus seeking to criminalize African Americans? On this week's Global Research News Hour, on the same week when Americans are commemorating the anniversary of Martin Luther King's birth, we look at a modern revolutionary named Mumia Abu-Jamal, fearlessly speaking truth to power from behind prison walls and at a time when his life is threatened with an untreated illness. In this hour, we'll hear from longtime supporter Suzanne Ross about his background and about the current state of the Free Mumia campaign. And we'll hear from Glenn Ford, executive editor of Black Agenda Report, about where Mumia fits in the larger scheme of repression of black people in America. on this week's show, Free Mumia, Stop the Slow-Motion Assassination of a Modern Revolutionary. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of January 22, 2015. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Revelations that involve Hillary Clinton and her email scandal confirms what the real motives of the U.S. NATO-led war on Libya to remove Muammar Gaddafi, and it was not for democracy or to protect the Libyan people. There are several reasons why Western powers want Africa under their control besides their appetite for natural resources, and that is to keep Africa under their control. Washington and Paris want to remain a dominant power politically and economically with their currencies in place instead of Gaddafi's idea, which called for the gold dinar to replace U.S. dollars and euros. Africa is to remain a captive market under the West because it is their corporations and special interest groups who should profit. U.S. presidential candidate Hillary Clinton and her email prove that the Obama and Sarkozy administrations wanted Libya's oil, gold, and silver under their control with their puppets or terrorists in place after Gaddafi was removed from power. That comes from the article, Hillary Clinton's emails confirm the real agenda behind the U.S.-NATO war on Libya, by Timothy Alexander Guzman, posted January 20th, originally appearing in Silent Crow News. The oil market is not the market of raw materials. Supply contracts for actual oil makes only 2% of the market. The rest, speculative securities, futures, and other derivatives. Prices for futures are not determined by supply and demand, but by expectations. The futures market is completely controlled by the largest U.S. banks. This is the market of expectations, which creates a real industry of expectations using the notorious rating agencies, independent experts, and the media. That comes from the article, Goldman Sachs Makes Oil Prices Drop, by Mikhail Leontiev, posted January 20th, originally appearing in the Russian language at 1TV Russia and on the Voltaire Network. Even as some of European youth's best and brightest have tried to fight the immense violence of neoliberalism via alter-globalization, the poorest among the young are now mired in violence and suicidal nihilism, extreme Wahhabism, which they've learned online. All across the spectrum, driven by fear, the toxic mix of political and economic instability continues to spread, leading quite a few insiders to wonder whether both the Fed and the Politburo Standing Committee in Beijing don't really know what's happening. And that once again feeds the warmongering hordes for which that good old-fashioned world war is the easiest ticket out. Cancel all the old debt, issue loads of new debt, turn plowshares and iPhones into cannons, and after a little thermonuclear exchange, welcome to full employment and a new wasteland of opportunity. That comes from the article Planet of Fear by Pepe Escobar, posted January 20th, originally appearing at Strategic Culture Foundation. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Mumia Abu-Jamal has spent more than half his life behind prison bars. In 1982, he was convicted on the charge of murder in the first degree over the shooting death of Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner. At the time of his arrest, Mumia Abu-Jamal was a supporter of the Revolutionary Move organization, a former member of the Black Panther Party, and a dissident radio journalist covering stories of police corruption and repression of people in the African-American community. He was president of the Philadelphia Association of Black Journalists. Unwilling to compromise his reporting, he did not work for any mainstream news organizations, preferring instead to work freelance and earn extra money by driving a taxicab. It is widely speculated that his fearless and uncompromising journalism and truth-telling was a little too inconvenient for certain entrenched interests, providing a motive to eliminate him. One fateful night in December of 1981, Mumia was driving his cab when he witnessed an altercation between his brother, William Cook, and a white police officer by the name of Daniel Faulkner. Mumia got out of his cab to investigate. When police arrived at the scene several minutes later, Faulkner was found dead with bullet wounds to the back and head. Mumia was sitting nearby with a bullet wound in the chest and a gun registered to him laying nearby. There were numerous irregularities in the legal process that followed, leading many close observers to conclude Mumia was unfairly prosecuted. For example, the impartiality of the judge, Albert F. Sabo, has been brought into serious question given his history of extensive involvement with police and law enforcement, which would conceivably affect his judgment in the case of the murder of a cop. A 1983 survey of members of the Philadelphia legal community found that as many as one-third of responding attorneys found him unqualified to be on the bench. Mumia was denied the right to legal counsel of his choice. Court-appointed attorney Anthony Jackson was imposed on him. Mumia's requests to be represented by John Africa were repeatedly denied by Sabo. Further, the defense was not allowed sufficient funds to employ an investigator, ballistics expert, or pathologist who could help shed some light on the facts around the case. The prosecution used 11 of its 15 peremptory strikes to remove African Americans from the jury, leaving only two black jurors on a jury of 16, that including alternate jurors. Out of proportion with the general population that was 40% African American. The case against Mumia rested on three pillars: a supposed confession he made when he was brought into the hospital that evening, eyewitnesses claiming to have seen him commit the crime, and the presence of Mumia's gun at the scene, alleged to have been the murder weapon. Three individuals, two police officers and a hospital security guard, claimed to have heard Mumia confess to the crime. He supposedly shouted it, even though doctors at the hospital claimed from the time he arrived that he was weak, on the verge of fainting. What's more, the alleged confession was not mentioned to investigators until February of 82, fully 2 months after the incident. Two of these witnesses claimed, implausibly, that they did not think the outburst was significant enough to report to police. One of the eyewitnesses, a prostitute named Cynthia White, claimed to have seen Mumia run up to Faulkner, shoot him in the back, and then fire a shot at his head while the wounded officer lay on the ground. There are indications that she had been enticed to offer an account favorable to the prosecution. A second prostitute, Veronica Jones, stated that she had likewise been given incentives to implicate Mumia in the killing but refused to cooperate. Judge Sabo had removed the jury during her deposition, so they were left unaware of the police offering inducements to these witnesses. Then there was the ballistics evidence. Police failed to test Mumia's gun properly to ascertain whether this was in fact the murder weapon. Medical records revealed that the bullet which penetrated Mumia's body was on a downward trajectory, not upwards, which is what one would expect if the bullet was fired from Faulkner while he lay on the ground, according to the prosecution's theory. The jury delivered a guilty verdict after 3 hours of deliberations and subsequently sentenced Mumia to death. The case was appealed to the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania in March of 1989 and denied. In 2001, a federal court judge ordered Mumia's death sentence be overturned. However, it would be another 11 years before Mumia would be released from death row. He remains in detention at the State Correctional Institute, Mahanoy, in Frackville, Pennsylvania, serving a sentence of life without parole. The latest chapter in the Mumia Abu-Jamal saga revolves around his suffering from the symptoms of hepatitis C, which is wreaking havoc on his body and causing him sleeplessness and pain. The Department of Corrections is apparently denying him the treatment which could save his life. Over the last 30 years, Mumia Abu-Jamal has become an international icon, with activist organizations springing up to demand his release. Mumia has released 8 books while in captivity, including Live from Death Row, Harper Perennial, and The Classroom in the Cell, Conversations on Black Life in America from Third World Press. He has written numerous articles and has released frequent radio essays, podcast at the site prisonradio.org. He's also the subject of the 2013 documentary, Long Distance Revolutionary. Glenn Ford will join us later in the hour to provide some important political and historic context to the Mumia Abu-Jamal story, but first we get an interview from a longtime advocate. We're joined right now by Suzanne Ross. She's a clinical psychologist and international representative of International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal. She's also active with the Free Mumia Abu-Jamal Coalition and has been a longtime anti-imperialist activist. She joins us from New York City. How are you today, Suzanne?
Good morning. Good morning.
I was wanting to get a bit of a short summary of Mumia's situation. I know you could probably go on for hours about what you see as the miscarriage of justice in his case, but I'm wondering if you could just explain why, as you see it, the original arrest and charge for the murder of white officer Daniel Faulkner does represent, in fact, a miscarriage of justice. I mean, maybe the two or three key bullet points.
Okay, well, let's put it in the context, first of all, that Mumia had been an activist since he was quite young, 14, 15, and had been followed by the FBI. The FBI records on him date back to when he was 14 years old, when he was beaten up for speaking out against George Wallace, believe it or not. So they were following him early. And he was he helped form the Black Panther Party chapter in Philadelphia, soon became the communications director at age 16 or something like that, and again called more and more attention to himself by being so outspoken in Philadelphia. He ultimately became a journalist, and as a journalist spoke, had a show on a black station, and people would run home to listen to this show because he was the voice of the voiceless. He became named the voice of the voiceless at that time because he spoke about all the racism and disenfranchisement of the poor and the outrageous repression of the Rizzo regime and so on that was happening at the time. So for people who know about the COINTELPRO operations, counterintelligence operations that J. Edgar Hoover began, it was not surprising that they would eventually get him, just as they killed so many people, notably Fred Hampton Jr. and so many young, gifted activists in the Black Panther Party were killed or jailed or whatever. It was not surprising that someone as gifted as Mumia and as well-known at a young age as him would be targeted. And so that's how the story starts. He shows up. He's at a street. I don't know if you want the details of how he got arrested and so on, but he got arrested on very questionable circumstances where he was running to go help his brother who was being beaten by the police. He saw his brother, ran over there, and before he knew it, literally before he knew it, he was beaten so badly that he was rushed to the hospital and nearly died and charged with the killing of the officer, even though someone else had been at the scene of the shooting who was much, much more likely. Mumia had no arrests prior to that date and no charges or anything like that and was known to be a nonviolent peacemaker. So being in that context and with a very, very corrupt group of police officers who were quickly assigned to that scene, 15 of whom were later indicted for other things, for corruption and so on, and a particular officer who was clearly involved in a conspiracy to get Mumia and other radicals. I mean, this is an era where the targeting of black radicals was considered a key strategy. We learn more and more about that. So the conspiracy goes on. Mumia's case is assigned. He's denied the opportunity to get his own attorney, denied the opportunity to speak in the trial. All kinds of things happen to him, and the judge who's assigned to the case is a notorious racist, old, came out of retirement to handle this case, and known to be a close friend of the Fraternal Order of Police for decades. And this is the judge who takes over the case. And in the process of the trial, even the mainstream press in Philadelphia began saying, we got to get rid of this judge. It's too much of an embarrassment. You know, the guy is guilty. People, you know, they all assumed Mumia was guilty. But let's get a decent judge that doesn't make it look so bad. Well, if they had had a decent judge, Mumia would never have been convicted. You know,
Some significant legal point. Yeah,
that in order for him to be convicted, they needed a corrupt, racist judge who was willing to break all the rules and who was overheard to say during the trial in a courtroom next door to his own, "I'm going to help them fry that nigger," and that's a quote. "I'm going to help them fry that nigger," and he had, excuse my use of the word, and he, a very, very respectable type court stenographer, testified that she overheard him say this.
Okay.
So that's just the beginning of, as you said, I could go on for years, but that's how it started. Mumia gets convicted. He gets sentenced to death. Even if you thought he was guilty and the trial was fair, the judges in the federal court who reviewed the case, you know, after it was finished in state court, ruled, Judge Yan in particular, ruled that the assignment of the death penalty to someone, and he supported the idea that Mumia was guilty, but he said that he never should have been given the death penalty because they didn't get a chance to even present mitigating arguments, you know, of the fact that Mumia had never had an arrest record, that he was revered, really, in the community, was seen as a peacemaker, all kinds of people willing to testify for him, et cetera, et cetera. And in 2000, this judge ruled that Mumia should not be on death row and should be removed for death row and sentenced to life in prison. It took 11 years for them to take him off death row. 11 years after the judge ruled this, because the city of Philadelphia appealed it and kept wanting to insist that the death penalty should continue. When they finally took him off death row, they decided not to appeal it anymore. I guess it looked pretty bad for them. And all the evidence was that this was an outrageous ruling. I mean, not only was it outrageous that Mumia was found guilty, but even more outrageous that he was sentenced to death. So he was removed from death row, which was a victory of ours, meaning that's not what we wanted. We wanted his release, but it was a victory in the sense that we forced them to get him off death row. And for years, that had been one of the major demands, of course, a key demand. No executions, stop the death penalty, et cetera, et cetera. And internationally, there had been outrage.
So it was basically, you're saying it was the political pressure more than just the wheels of the legal system that eventually got him free from death row?
Unquestionably so.
Okay.
Unquestionably, because as you see, the political wheels took 11 years mm-hmm. to get him off death row when they themselves had ruled that he should never have been on death row. It took 11 years to get him off that. I mean, think of how shocking that is. Keeping this person in total isolation, not being able to touch anybody, his, you know, his wife, his children, his grandchildren, not being able to leave his cell without shackles on him, not being able to see anyone without in a contact visit. In other words, I visited him during that time, and, you know, there was always a plexiglass between us. And being treated as this continuous horror monster cop killer, how they called him all the time, even though Judge Yon had ruled that he should be off death row. And eventually he was removed based on that original ruling, but 11 years later. Talk about the wheels of justice working slowly. We should say the wheels of injustice work quickly, meaning they keep the oppression going forever if they can. And we did have major campaigns internationally all over the world. Streets were named after Mumia. Medals and honors were given to him. In fact, we're just going back to Paris, to a little suburb of Paris called Saint-Denis, where 10 years ago, in April 2006, a street was named after Mumia in Saint-Denis, and we're going back to celebrate the 10th year anniversary. And the police in Philadelphia went crazy about it at the time and demanded that the name be removed and that an apology be given to the police and so on and so on. And the people of Saint-Denis were very courageous and insisted on their right to honor Mumia. And so we're going back this April to celebrate that. So this has been a struggle with many, many facets of the people's voice versus the state, the repressive apparatus of the United States government and all the forces behind them that have really, and I use this word scientifically, not rhetorically, have really conspired to kill Mumia.
So December 2011, district attorney Seth Williams announced that they would no longer seek the death penalty for Mumia Abu-Jamal, and then the next month was released into the general prison population. So I was just wondering, like, that period from the time that he was released into the general population to 2015, what kind of treatment was he receiving? What kind of reception from prison authorities? Is there anything particularly unusual about it, or was it
pretty
standard?
Well, thank you, first of all, for summarizing again the role, you know, how that happened, the 2011 ruling, and Seth Williams so despondently announced that he wasn't going to be able to seek the death penalty any longer. But even at that moment, I mean, there hasn't been a moment when we haven't had to fight. So at that moment, when he was taken out of SCI, State Correctional Institution at SCI Green, where in Waynesboro, where he had been for many, many years on death row, he was transferred to SCI Mahanoy in Fraxville. Isn't that ironic, that word, for people in Canada in particular who've struggled about the environmental issues, that these towns are named with such names is definitely not by chance. At any rate, he is now transferred in 2011, at the end of 2011, to Mahanoy, and they put him in isolation where, you know, for people who are not on death row, but people who violated infraction, who have infractions or who are considered dangerous for one reason or another. And they put him in this oppressive situation where he could only have visitors now for 1 hour, no phone calls, and the most horrific conditions, seemingly as punishment for having won the right to not be executed. So we waged a fight then. We went up to the Mumia said, put me back on death row at one point. He said, rather than this. I mean, he said the conditions were horrendous. So we waged a fight, and we went to the head of the Department of Corrections, the headquarters of Department of Corrections, and basically did a little sit-in. At that point, I was also dealing with Juan Mendez, who's the Special Commissioner on Torture of the United Nations Human Rights Commission, who had issued that wonderful statement, heroic statement about being in isolation for more than 2 weeks should be considered torture. Back about 5 years ago, he issued that statement, which had huge reverberations. So we had gone to see him and asked him to convene. So we came to SCI, and we came to the headquarters of Department of Corrections and said, look, we're getting in touch now with Juan Mendez. We're demanding investigation by the United Nations. We're not going to leave until you release him, blah, 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 blah. And there were about 20 of us, I think, at the time. We did this kind of on the spur of the moment, really. And we were told, Mumia had been told that day that unless he signed papers saying that saying that he would not hold the prison authorities responsible in any way if something happened to him in the prison once he was released into general population, you know, that he would never be released if he didn't sign that. Now, that's basically an invitation or collaboration with allowing them to kill him because, you know, they set up people to be killed. And when they say, we want you to sign papers saying we're not responsible, Mumia is not, to say the least, is not stupid about the system.
I was thinking the same thing. Who, excuse my language, the hell would sign something like that?
Exactly, exactly. So that was what they asked him at the end of December 2011. That's what they were asking him to do. And he said, no way, of course. When we came to the prison, we knew that. I mean, to the DOC, to the Department of Corrections. When we did this little sit-in at the Department of Corrections, we knew that they were threatening Mumia with that. Guess what? We told them we would be back again and again and again, and that we were going to get this to the United Nations. The next morning, they show up in his cell, release him, and ask him nothing about signing. Nothing about signing. And he was released into general population at that point with, you know, the ordinary conditions of general population. And it is a tribute to our movement. The Mumia movement has been extraordinary in its consistency, in its internationalism, in its creativity, and so many other things about it, that we were able to get Mumia released despite that threat that he would never get out if he didn't sign that paper. And he got out the next morning without signing anything.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. I know that you'd put out the statement that that the Department of Corrections should be held accountable not only for medical malpractice, but medical malfeasance.
Right.
And I'm wondering if you could explain what you meant by that.
Well, first of all, he was in the infirmary for a few, I can't remember how long, in the month of February. And he documented what they did with him during that month. Well, one of the things they did is they did blood tests. The blood tests clearly showed two things. One, that he had, which they already knew when he was transferred out of death row into general population, they did blood tests and found that he had hepatitis C. That's the first Mumia knew of it. So he first found out in 2011 that he had hepatitis C. But they didn't do any tests on it. They didn't investigate it. They didn't recommend anything to him about how he should deal with it. Lo and behold, he ends up with a skin problem starting in 2014, the summer of 2014. He thinks it's just itching. He minimizes it. By January and February of 2015, he's getting sicker and sicker. He goes to the infirmary. They start, quotes, treating him. Well, one, they don't deal with the hepatitis C, which they now, you know, they know he has. And two, they don't tell him that his blood sugar is elevated, dangerously elevated. He knows nothing about that. To make a long story short, in that period, and everything is, of course, a long story, on March 30th of last year, Mumia passes out and goes into a diabetic shock, rushed to the hospital. They find that his sugar level is so high that he could have easily died, and that probably the treatment they gave him, I mean, this is the hypothesis, but, you know, we're still not sure, the treatment they gave him for his skin, which included steroids, may have set off this episode of intense diabetes. He had never had diabetes before. And also now, with the additional information that some doctor who's come onto the case, who's very, very good, has diagnosed that this is probably a case of that the hepatitis C could have contributed to the creation of the development of the diabetes. So whatever it is, they gave him diabetes.
Okay.
He had never had it before. And he's rushed to the hospital. They keep him there for one day, two nights, bring him back to the prison, offer him nothing. You know, he gets pasta for dinner and some kind of cake, dessert, and, you know, I mean, totally not dealing with his diet and totally not taking seriously that his life had just been endangered. Of course, he gets sick again. He's then rushed to the hospital again. And I think it was the beginning of May by that time, early May, he's rushed to a different hospital, much better hospital, where they do extensive tests and keep him there for a little over a week and recommend that his hepatitis C be further assessed. His diabetes eventually disappears. We don't know what that means, you know, if it's gone forever or just ameliorate, whatever, you know, but he's not sick from diabetes anymore because he's not given the steroids. And he is returned to the infirmary at SCI Mahanoy, where he continues to be right now. And in the process, they never diagnosed what he had. The prison doctors at the prison, the infirmary doctors, and all the consultants they brought in, and you should hear we heard them in court. They sound like these these consultants. I tell you, I'm a child of Nazi Europe, and I was raised on the whole idea of doctors being torturers and doctors collaborating with the government and with the enemy and repressive forces. I mean, I know the stories, and I couldn't help but think of that as I'm listening to these horrendous doctors in the courtroom. That was just in December when we were in court in Scranton. I'm jumping ahead at this point. At any rate, the lawyer, Mumia's lawyer, then file for demanding treatment because the doctor who has seen him only in the visiting room, he's not allowed to see Mumia to treat him as a patient because they're not recognizing him as a doctor. They just recognize their own doctors. But he's a very smart black doctor who spent time in around the world, worked with Doctors Without Borders, and is experienced both in HIV and hepatitis C, and looked at Mumia and said, he's suffering from the symptoms of hepatitis C, and that's what the skin problem is about, and that's why he's so sick, and he needs to get the new miracle drug, which has worked on hepatitis C, cures people, literally cures people.
And it's been endorsed by several high, you know, very prominent associations, including the World Health Organization, the Infectious Disease Society of America, and other, I guess, you know, medical authorities outside of the consultants that this DOC is contracting.
Exactly. They're the only ones who are not recognizing this treatment. But ironically, this is a as a matter of fact, I just finished taking it because I got a hepatitis C through a blood transfusion that I didn't even know about 30 years ago. And once this medicine became available, I decided to take it, and I immediately got cured. So it's known to be very, very effective, and with minimal side effects that people know about so far, at least. And the doctor urged that Mumia get it immediately because his symptoms were so serious. It wasn't just hepatitis C. Like, I never had any symptoms like Mumia had. Mumia is black. Some of the symptoms that he's exhibiting are unique or overwhelmingly prevalent among black people who have hepatitis C. And this is what this doctor came up with, this wonderful analysis of what's happening and why Mumia is showing these symptoms. And to contrast him with the doctors that the prison showed as in the courtroom a couple of weeks ago when we were there as part of the challenge to the Department of Corrections to get Mumia this treatment. And so we had witnesses, you know, the doctors in the who saw Mumia in the infirmary or who consulted about him. Some of them didn't even see him. Give their interpretation of why he shouldn't get it. And ultimately, he shouldn't get it because he's a prisoner. And they, one of them didn't know anything about the drug, seemed to not know anything about hepatitis C, the skin doctor who was the specialist, and then the guy who was head of the whole Department of Corrections medical facility, his name is Dr. Cowan. He acknowledged on very clever questioning by Mumia's attorney, Bob Boyle, he acknowledged that if somebody came to him in private practice and had the insurance to cover this very, very expensive medication, which is another outrage, what the pharmaceutical companies do with this, that he would recommend this drug. But in Mumia's case, he doesn't recommend it.
So
a double standard of treatment for those who are lucky not to be in prison and happen to have the insurance for it, and versus those who happen to be in prison and treated as though their lives don't matter at all, and given the kind of treatment that Mumia has gotten. And Mumia has gotten better treatment for sure than the thousands of other people in prison because there's a movement behind him. So we demand all the time the same care for Mumia, for the other prisoners to get the same care, those who have hepatitis C. Our campaign has focused heavily on all the prisoners. And that's where we're at the point, this point. You know, we've had this hearing. We've had these hearings in court. They were very impressive. Our side was very impressive, our lawyers, our doctor.
So this lawsuit isn't just for Mumia. It's essentially for everybody who's behind bars, who's being denied, who's subjected to this kind of double standard of treatment.
Well,
when
it
comes to Hep C.
The particular case that the lawyers, they lawyers can't simply represent thousands of prisoners.
But there's
know?
Implications, right?
Implications of that. And our campaign focuses on the thousands of prisoners. And there are other suits that have been brought in Pennsylvania against the Department of Corrections. And in the process of this campaign, one of the wonderful things was that we and some of the black legislators demanded that the Department of Corrections show us their protocol for how they treat hepatitis C. Well, they said they had no protocol. So we said, so get one, you know, write one up. So in the courtroom, we finally got the new guidelines. They finally came up. They had to come up with a protocol. They have somewhere between 7 and 12,000 people with hepatitis C in the prison. And so they couldn't say they're not going to have a protocol. They came up with a protocol that is obscene because it lists about 500 conditions. I'm exaggerating. All kinds of conditions under which people should not get this medicine. And the whole focus is on who should not get the treatment. So anyone who has ever rejected treatment before, anyone who's ever used drugs, anyone who is not really, I mean, the condition of getting the medicine is that you have to be so sick that you have internal bleeding caused in the esophagus. And, of course, not surprisingly, only 6 people have gotten the medicine in all of Pennsylvania's prisons. So when you read that document, you go, oh, my God, talk of genocide. I mean, they're willing to casually talk of denying people basic medical care that as you mentioned earlier, all these mainstream organizations, I say, treat it as quickly as you can. The longer you wait, the worse the prognosis. Treat it as quickly as you can under all circumstances. In other words, everybody who has it. You know, you don't have to be dying. You don't have to be have a huge, a viral load. That's one of the things that you measure in hepatitis C, viral load. The prison says, well, if your viral load isn't very high, you don't have... Well, all the doctors and everybody says the viral load has very little to do with how sick you are and whether you should be eligible for this treatment. So that's where we're at now. We're waiting to hear from the court. The 3 days were quite remarkable. I would say the movement showed itself to be very impressive in its ethics, in its competence. And the state of Pennsylvania showed itself to be totally reprehensible, both in its ethics, lack of ethics, and its incompetence.
In our interview, Suzanne Ross stressed the importance of bringing international pressure to bear on the governor of Pennsylvania to assist Mumia.
I think that's an important thing that people can do, because the governor is not the worst. He actually signed a moratorium on the death penalty. Pennsylvania is one of the states in the United States that still has the death penalty. And as soon as he came into office, as he had promised, he shockingly signed this moratorium in the face of the Fraternal Order of Police and the Republican Party and many other people being opposed to it. So he has some courage, some principles. And contacting him is not just an existential. I don't believe it's just an exercise in futility. And the fact that we had a letter circulated that Archbishop Tutu and Minister Farrakhan and Cornel West and all kinds of people signed this letter addressed to the governor back in, I believe that was in April, means that continuing to focus on him, I think, is strategic. And from around the world, to get those messages from around the world, I think is important.
Okay, well, Suzanne Ross, I think we'll have to leave it there, but I want to thank you very much for sharing this this important story and these important updates with our listening audience, and I wish you all the best as the campaign moves forward.
And what a pleasure it's been to talk with you and find you so knowledgeable and supportive, and I hope you continue on this station and continue to do the work you do.
All the best.
Bye-bye.
We've been speaking with Suzanne Ross, International Representative of International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal and active with the Free Mumia Abu-Jamal Coalition, also a longtime anti-imperialist activist. Joining us now from Plainsfield, New Jersey, is Glenn Ford. He is the executive editor for Black Agenda Report, an online resource providing news and analysis from the black left. Glenn Ford, welcome to our program.
Thanks for the invitation.
I'm wondering if I could get from you your assessment as to why Mumia was targeted.
If you're speaking of why the Philadelphia police focused on Mumia, And outside of the larger context of why black males and the black community in general have been targeted for a particular brand of oppression by the U.S. government, well, Mumia was a radio reporter. He worked for a number of radio stations. He was well known to the police, even aside and apart from the high-profile role that he played in the police conflict with the MOVE organization in Philadelphia. So the cops knew who Mumia Abu-Jamal was. He was the reporter who would not take as gospel the police version of events, and in fact would bring not a prejudice but a wisdom of the oppressed to a news story about conflicts between the people and the police. So he was not a question mark. He was not just another brother to be beat down in the street and framed, although that's quite enough of an excuse for a cop in any American city. He was a target because they knew him and they knew his work.
Okay. Now, we are having this conversation just 4 days after Martin Luther King Day, when another very, charismatic and outspoken leader is being honored. Both King and Mumia appear to have been threats to that establishment. Did you see any significant differences in emphasis in terms of the way both these men have been targeted?
We have to look at not just Dr. King and Mumia, but all black folks who are political, who are in opposition to the prevailing order, as coming under the same category as far as the state is concerned. That is, every large police department, whether it admits it or not, has a bureau that specializes in dissidents, and that bureau usually is specializes in dissidents who come from the black community or some other minority community. This is part of American policing. That is, on the macro level, we have a system of mass black incarceration that stigmatizes and targets all black folks as criminals or potential criminals who are in need of containment. So the subcategory of folks in that larger group are those who might organize the larger black group for resistance, and those are the leaders. The police don't parse the difference between a King's democratic socialism and a black power. A Black Panthers' revolutionary nationalism. What they are concerned about is whether the people who are targeted are able to unite the larger group of black folks whose job it is for the police to contain.
Now, in your speeches and your writing, and I think what you've been talking about is the sentiment that since the late 1960s, right up into today under President Barack Obama, the U.S. government has been engaged in a counterinsurgency against the black population. And I'm wondering what it was about the 1960s that may have triggered that response.
Well, of course, as everyone knows, hundreds of cities went up in flames in the 1960s, and especially, of course, in 1968 in April after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. But just as importantly, inseparable from that, is the fact that black folks, not just the Panther Party, but many other organizations who are forgotten now because they were stamped out during that general repression of 69 and 70 and during that period, that it is black folks who were developing an ideology of resistance that was radically socialist, although sometimes called African socialist, but radically socialist, absolutely anti-imperialist, and far more uncompromising than anything that the United States had seen that had taken root among masses of young people up to that time. They really were afraid of revolutionary black nationalism, of black politicization of any kind. And that's why J. Edgar Hoover said that the Black Panther Party was the greatest danger to national security domestically of the United States. But he also said that Dr. Martin Luther King was the most dangerous single personality in the United States. That's why I pointed out that it really doesn't matter to these people whether you're talking about a revolutionary nationalist organization like the Panther Party or a Nobel Peace Prize winner like Dr. King. Both of them were anti-imperialist. Both of them were uncompromising in terms of the principles of the state being subordinate to the people rather than the other way around. Both were seen as class one dangers to the stability of the American order at that time. And, of course, all of this with the background of constant warfare between blacks and whites in the United States, if you consider that slavery was a warfare, and that the suppression of Reconstruction was warfare, and that the imposition of Jim Crow terror, either by the Klan or Jim Crow police against black folks for 100 years after the Civil War was terror. In that kind of situation, counterinsurgency, that is the suppression of those who are resisting being repressed, is a normal state of affairs in the United States, one that was just ramped up dramatically at the end of the 1960s.
We hear about the military-industrial complex, and of course there's this prison-industrial complex with mass incarceration, which generates profits for certain individuals, raises stock values, creates jobs, and so on. So I'm wondering if you might be able to comment on the economics incentives of this counterinsurgency that you speak of it maintaining that violent status quo, if not instigating it, and how the economics of the counterinsurgency might undermine revolutionary activity.
Yeah, I'm not one of those who believes that the profitability of the prison industrial complex is the primary reason that it continues to survive and thrive. I think that the security of the state and the capitalist system that the state protects is the most important reason for mass black incarceration and all of the attendant crimes that go with mass black incarceration. But the profitability of the system is important to different sectors. It's important if you're upstate, that is in New York, upstate is where the prisons are, or if you're in Illinois, downstate, where the prisons are, because those become bulwarks of the local economy in those overwhelmingly white areas, which are disproportionately represented in state legislatures and therefore have outside political weight. Also, prison guards are mostly unionized, and so they are a Trojan horse in the labor movement. You know, one of our supposedly most progressive unions asked me, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, although it is politically progressive on most issues, the entire organization is held back by the presence of these hundreds of thousands of prison guards, most of whom belong to AFSCME. And they, of course, agitate for an intensification of mass black incarceration, because that makes their jobs more secure and gives them more bargaining power. So they're a curse and cancer on the labor movement. And now, of course, there are a number of prison corporations that sell stock on the U.S. Stock Exchange. They have to notify their potential investors that the potential profits of the company are subject to the political winds that might affect the rate of mass incarceration. Empty beds in prison mean lower profits for stockholders. So there is an embedded investment cadre out there who have a vested direct interest every quarter in the maintenance and spread of mass incarceration. But again, the primary reason for the United States being the mass incarceration state in the world is because of the perceived and real threat that an aroused and organized black population represents to the political order here.
Now, one more quick question. In addition to the question of this mass incarceration, the detention of Mumia, we've also seen the tragedies of the killings of Trayvon Martin and Tamir Rice and on, and it's given birth to the Black Lives Matter and similar solidarity movements. And I'm wondering if you have any concerns about groups which raise awareness about these injustices, but don't place it in that context of a counterinsurgency.
Yeah, if it's not understood in its historical context, then it becomes inevitable that those who agitate and work up the people and get people looking forward to a struggle for real solutions to the crisis, it becomes inevitable that they focus on proceduralisms and petty reforms. So it becomes the lack of a larger vision as to why the police treat us like they do, what the police mission is, rather than the kind of clothes they wear or the caliber of weapons that they carry, ultimately means that you'll have a short-lived and very frustrated movement. But all the indications are that there are enough folks with a healthy historical vision involved in the current incipient movement that we won't get bogged down in those proceduralisms. The biggest danger to this movement is getting entangled with the Democratic Party, which in Black America is hegemonic in its presence. It's in all of the political churches. It infests all of our fraternities and sororities, in addition, of course, to being the party of virtually all Black elected and appointed officials. So the Democratic Party is the great impediment to any effective revolutionary organization in the Black community, because it's everywhere.
Well, Glenn Ford, I think I speak for our greater listenership when I say we really appreciate the refreshing perspectives that you provided for us today. Thank you for joining us, and I hope we can speak again.
Yes, just give me a call.
And we've been speaking with Glenn Ford, executive editor for Black Agenda Report. His articles and commentaries appear on the website blackagendareport.com. Many of his essays also appear at globalresearch.ca. One final note. If you are in the New York City area, this Monday, January 25th, there will be a report back on Mumia's condition and the current state of the legal proceedings to get the treatment he needs and plans moving forward. That takes place at the historic Riverside Church at 91 Claremont Avenue in room 9T. This event is free and open to the public. For more details about Mumia's plight and how to help, please visit www.freemumia.com. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.